meeting of Parliament, Wednesday, 1st of July. We continue with the second reading of the Appropriations Bill.
The Honourable Sir Joe Bussano.
Mr. Speaker, the 23rd of last month was the 49th anniversary of my election to this House. On the 10th, I had my 82nd birthday, and GBC made a point of congratulating me as a news item, which I appreciate very much. However, they said I was going to be 33 years old, an innocent error which I am sure does not mean that they want to accelerate my aging process. I have also been wished well by many people, not all of whom vote for me, with one person in particular doing so at 1 minute past midnight on the 9th to be the first. I am grateful for the warmth of all those well wishes, irrespective of whether they agree with my political views or not. Given that I have in the past, some 20 years ago, said that I would offer myself as a candidate to the GSLP until I was 90, I would not want anybody to think that there is now only 7 years left as a result of the mistake by GBC. In fact, I have since put the record straight and made clear that I could see no valid reason for throwing the towel in so soon. And therefore, my offer to my party is that they can continue to count on me for at least 8 years, and hopefully for many more after that. I know that this will disappoint some sectors of the community, obviously not on this side of the House, who have wanted to see my name disappear from the ballot paper for a long time. But since everything I have done as a member of this House is driven by what I am convinced is in the best interest of Gibraltar, even those who want to see the back of me stand to gain if I turn out to be right in my analysis of what is best for us. Before I proceed with my analysis of the issues that are relevant to this year's budget, I want to deal with accusations that have been made outside this House where I've been the target. I am dealing with them here because those making the accusations have been or are members of the House. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Mr. Bussano, who at the moment is not here, chose to launch an attack on me in an opinion published by the Gibraltar Chronicle on the 15th of March. In it, he accuses me of doing a U-turn on my views in relation to Spain of such magnitude that he says it is the biggest U-turn in the history of humanity since the conversion of Paul. I will quote what he wrote. The U-turn, however, was not in our midst, but on the very night in the mouth of Sir Joe Bussano, who underwent a miraculous metamorphosis last seen on the road leading to Damascus when St. Paul famously converted to Christianity. I had been so struck by what Sir Joe had said that I had to watch his speech again like a doubting Thomas. The man who had been the incarnation of militant hawkishness for a generation and more, the man who said no to every initiative at closer cooperation with Spain from the Strasbourg process to the Brussels and airport agreements, our own Maggie with his no, 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 was here telling us that a treaty that had to be done with Spain because the pressure was too great. We were naked and crawling. Let me first correct the Honourable Member's misrepresentation of where I was in the past, which incidentally is where I still am today and will continue to be in the future. I am the man who created the first initiative on mutually beneficial cooperation with the hinterland as Chief Minister. This was done with Pepe Caracal, the then President of the Mancomunidad de Municipios. However, I insisted that the cooperation should be with individual municipalities as members and not the Mancomunidad, because the Spanish government had intended the Mancomunidad should have a Gibraltar seat. The Our Lady of Europa Economic Coordination Council, as it was called, started originally with Algeciras and Gibraltar as members and then was joined by other municipalities from the campo, and finally Ceuta. The last session was held in Ceuta, and after that it stopped meeting as a result of the implementation of the freeze on old age pensions for Spanish pre-1969 frontier workers, about which I will have to say more at a later stage. At the same time as I was promoting cooperation with the nearby neighbours, I was campaigning against the attempted betrayals of our sovereignty in the Strasbourg talks with Señor Oreja in 76-77, the Lisbon Agreement in 1980, the Brussels Agreement in 1984, and the 1987 Airport Agreement. Both of the latter were then stopped and boycotted by the socialist government that I led between 1988 and 1996, concurrently with the initiatives on cooperation with no strings attached that I have previously mentioned. The fact that the Honourable Member describes our opposition to these attempts, these instances of attempted betrayals of our sovereignty, as saying no to initiatives at closer cooperation with Spain, says a great deal about who is the Palomo in this house, him or me. Mr. Speaker, may I also remind him that eventually the party that he hopes to lead, well led by Sabita Caruana, also rejected belatedly the Brussels Agreement and the 1987 Airport Agreement. Were those saying no, 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 like Maggie Thatcher? Let's be clear in this house, and let the people of Gibraltar be clear what the accusation against me is. If Paul shifted from persecuting Christians to advocating Christianity, then the Honourable Member is suggesting that I have gone from no talks on sovereignty to make Gibraltar Spanish. I will not say the Honourable Member is lying, but I am urging him to seriously consider a visit to a psychiatrist, because he seems to have lost his wits. If he had been telling the truth, it would mean that in accepting the tax deal with Spain on the basis that, in my judgment, it represents no risk to our economy and no threat to our sovereignty, I would have been lying. It would mean that I have been lying to the Gibraltarians who have placed their trust in me for the last 49 years in the belief I would never put Gibraltar at risk of a takeover by Spain. That is the seriousness of the accusation against me from the Honourable Member. So when he witnessed this radical change happening, how did he react on the 25th of February, on the day? Not 18 days later, on March the 15th, he didn't react. No reaction at all, not a word. I am not saying that he was lying in the article to deceive the people of Gibraltar. I am assuming that he believes this extraordinary nonsense that he has published. How else can a pious, traditional Christian like him act other than by saying what he believes to be true? Is he not the equivalent in Christianity of someone with a fundamentalist faith? Which, of course, he's perfectly entitled to be, and is totally acceptable in our tolerant society, and for which I have not the least criticism at all. I respect his beliefs. I am a fundamentalist myself, a fundamentalist in saying no to Spain. But I ask myself, how could someone with those strict beliefs make a comparison with the conduct of St. Paul? Is it not almost inevitable to argue that the monumental U-turn of Paul from persecutor to promoter of Christianity had a great deal to do with the success of Christianity? So, is that the sort of conversion of Joe Bozzano from fiendish opponent to even the very thought of discussing sovereignty with Spain, let alone conceding it? Has it gone a miraculous change to now becoming an advocate for a Spanish Gibraltar? The hawk has become the greatest Palomo in Gibraltar's history. Is that what the Honourable Member believes? And if this is all nonsense, and this is what he compares to what happened to Paul, do we need now to go back and revise what might have happened to Paul on his way to Damascus after all? So, is it that the Honourable Member did not listen to me saying that if there was no deal, I would be the one to put the first brick. Was that the dove going back to being a hawk? Will St. Paul be retreating from the road to Damascus and return to persecuting Christians? That is a matter for theologians. But I will let this house into a secret. I had no intention of speaking in the debate, but when I arrived, I was ambushed in the antechamber by the honorable member before I entered, and he said he could not understand why I was in favor of the tax treaty. And I explained it to him, and he then said it was unfair to Gibraltarians who wanted to live in Spain. And I said you couldn't have your bread buttered on both sides. If some Gibraltarians wanted to live in Spain, then they had to comply with the Spanish laws. He then said he understood my position. And so I decided that this merited that I should explain it for the benefit of the other members on the other side of the house. I have to say that I was not relying on any privileged information that was not in the public domain, and I was surprised that other members should need any explanation from me, which I think could have been given by any person that has been following the details of the events and analyzed the reaction that emerged from the EU and Margallo and their behavior after the 2016 referendum result was announced. I will remind the House how the honorable member opposite reacted after the 2016 referendum was announced. This is what I said about it in the 2016 budget. Last Thursday, Mr. Speaker, the former member of parliament, Mr. Osino, put forward a very pessimistic view of the consequences of the decision to leave the EU and quoted me in support of his views, saying I had said we would be doing well if we met my economic growth predictions included in the 2015 manifesto, but that the future predicted growth that I had in mind was now out of the picture. Well, Mr. Speaker, I actually thought that what I have said on a number of occasions before the vote took place or the result was known, and what I repeated in answer to the supplementary from the leader of the opposition last week, was actually quite positive for Gibraltar's prospects. Mr. Mocino also demanded that politicians should look him straight in the eye and tell him what the future held for him. I do not know how many people he used to look straight in the eye and tell them what the future held for them when he was a politician. Nor do I understand why he believed that politicians have the power to see the future, that they lose that power when they leave politics as he has done. However, I am, I suppose, one of the few politicians that has regularly predicted our country's potential economic future on a 4-year time cycle. And so I'm quite happy to look opposite members in the eye, and since Mr. Osino is not here, which was the case in 2016 and it's the case again today, I repeat my prediction. Or maybe since no one is supposed to speak through the chair, Mr. Speaker, I need to be looking into your eye when I say what I have to say. The projected growth of our economy calculated and published in 2015 is an increase in our GDP of 600 million by the year 1920, being 33.3% of the estimated value for 15-16. That was what I said in the budget 2016. Well, I'm happy to tell him now that my prediction was right and that he will see that when I deal with the economy. So his concern that Brexit would invalidate the prediction has proved to be unnecessary. But I have decided to take his advice, but I am frustrated that I'm not able to deliver it because I would like to be saying all this and looking him in the eye.
Where is he?
Mr. Speaker, what I told Mr. Clinton in the debate was my simple explanation of how the PSOE government would defend themselves in Spain. I said the one thing the PSOE could not do was to say we are not going to put sovereignty on the table, we are not going to put anything on the table. We will go and ask Mr. Clinton, will you give us a standard OECD agreement, and then go back and say, obviously in Spain, what a great achievement, we've got all the aces, we have these people naked and crawling, and we have extracted from them an OECD agreement. That's what I said. Mr. Osino misinterpreted or deliberately misrepresented as me having said that we are naked and crawling, and as a result have had to accept the tax treaty with Spain. When the mover of the motion on the tax treaty made his closing speech, he referred to me as follows. I am grateful to hear the Honourable Father of the House contribution, and let me start here on the point with him. He said that this debate was unrealistic in part. Well, I'm not sure that I would concede that to him. But if it has been realistic in part, it has been unrealistic because it has been made by them as unrealistic up till now, largely his contribution, because at least in his contribution, he recognized that this was a price for the Brexit transition deal in so many words. At a later stage, the Honourable Member wrote the following in the media. If the end game is reflected in the guidelines, sovereignty will undoubtedly be the issue. The nightmarish scenario is not only that Spain will hold the lock on our continued access in for the EU single market, but a further lock in the EU-UK deal. Talk about a double lock. That, somebody told me recently, was, yes, we could be British, but bankrupt. That is what he said when he was scared in 2016. That is what can be interpreted as us having no choice of either being British and poor or continue to be well off and Spanish. And that was his fear in 2016. This gave the impression that we were being subjected under pressure to a situation where the choice before us was that we will go bankrupt in order to stay British. This clearly implied that the deal on sovereignty would have to be done if we wanted to survive. These are the sentiments that they attributed to me this time. So I have no difficulty with the leader of the opposition saying that the tax treaty was part of the negotiations for Gibraltar to be included in the transition period. Whether we agree that treaty was good or bad is a matter of judgment. But that is a totally different thing from saying we have battered away sovereignty in order to be in the transition period. That did not happen, has not happened, and will not happen in anything else that we do with Spain. The second issue that I want to place on the record of the House, Mr. Speaker, is a letter written by Mr. Nett on the 11th of May 2020, which I would have dealt in the 2020 budget if there had been one, entitled Establishing Historical Facts, which he signed in his capacity as a former minister who served between the years of 1996 and 2011 and is therefore relevant to the business of this House. I will read the letter for the benefit of members. In his May Day message published in the Gibraltar Chronicle on Saturday the 2nd of May, the Chief Minister alludes to Joe Bolsano's introduction of the minimum wage back in the latter's tenure in government as something intrinsically socialist to be proud. As I have repeatedly told Mr. Picardo on numerous times before, I didn't know that he was on such close speaking terms, introducing the minimum wage and keeping it in line with annual inflation rate increases certainly is socialist to be proud of. Yet the minimum wage was a legislation back then when Joe Bolsano was the chief minister is nothing to be proud of as a socialist. So once again, let me set the record correct. In August 1989, this is Mr. Neto's version, the GSLP government introduced a standard minimum wage order in Gibraltar for weekly paid employees only. The only discernible reason for negating the standard minimum wage order generally throughout Gibraltar was that at the time, civil service administrative assistance hourly rate of pay was £1.68 for a 16-year-old, £1.82 for a 70-year-old, and £2.22 for an 18-year-old, and £2.36 for a 19-year-old person. These rates were less than the hourly rate of pay for newly introduced minimum wage of £2.50. Therefore, the GSLP government designed the minimum wage in order that the GSLP government as an employer could use the deliberate loophole of not applying the minimum wage to its employees because administrative assistants were employed and paid monthly. So we had a so-called socialist government to whom our current chief minister thinks Joe Bolsonaro is his socialist mentor, for which I'm grateful, deciding as an employer to keep its administrative assistance below the minimum wage in order to the above when the private sector employers found out they started transferring the weekly paid employees to monthly so that they could pay less than the hourly rate of the new minimum wage. There was then a movement to circumscribe the legislation, therefore rendering the law almost useless to thousands of employees throughout Gibraltar. I am proud, he says, that as Minister for Employment, I closed the deliberate loophole created by the GSLP, thus making all employers in Gibraltar comply with the minimum wage, both in the private and public sector, and for weekly paid and monthly paid. The amendment to the order was set as from the age of 16, thereby closing all the deliberate loopholes in 1989. In all probability, the chief ministers made a message for next year will continue to peddle the line that it was a great socialist party, the GSLP is, due to having enacted a minimum wage before the UK. Someone ought to inform him that being first does not necessarily mean getting the piece of legislation right. There are other vital issues for which a chief minister ought to steer away from having Joe Bolsonaro as a socialist mentor, but that will have to wait for another day. This letter is almost a repeat of the part of his farewell speech to the House in the 2015 budget, which was mainly about trying to convince everyone that I was not a socialist, and in the process demonstrating that they didn't have a clue that the fact is that socialism is a philosophy, not a social welfare program for the capitalist system, in spite of the fact that he somehow managed to get a degree in philosophy. Although I dealt with some of the things he said in 2015, I chose to ignore this point, so I feel the need to put the record straight now so that at least people will know that it is all nonsense if he wants to keep on peddling it. It seems that Mr. Neto feels offended that I should be considered a socialist, judging from the content of the letter. I believe Mr. Neto was living in Wales in 1988 when the first socialist government was formed in Gibraltar and decided to introduce the national minimum wage in 1989. Of course, Mr. Neto would not have had the protection of a national minimum wage in Wales. It took the United Kingdom 10 more years to follow the example of Gibraltar. The legislation we brought was, of course, intended to protect workers in the private sector, not in the public sector, who were on UK salary scales as a result of the successful campaign for parity which I led with the UK employers when I was involved in negotiating for the unions. So I will now place on record the historical facts. The minimum wage for weekly paid and monthly paid employees other than those on salary scales was introduced not to correct the national minimum wage. It was introduced for persons at the age of 18, so nobody in 16 or 17, clerical or otherwise, was covered by the minimum wage in August 89. In the 2001 budget, the chief minister announced the changes in the minimum wage to which Mr. Neto refers in his letter, saying the following: I think there has been an unprecedented progress. By unprecedented, I mean in all the years that the Gibraltarians have been conducting their own affairs, there has been unprecedented progress in infrastructure improvement and the working conditions of thousands and thousands of ordinary working people in Gibraltar. This is the GSD view of themselves. The minimum wage has been raised from 3.26 to 3.75. And it now applies to all workers, whether they are paid weekly or monthly, subject only to a few logical exemptions, to which, as a leader of the opposition, I replied that to raise a minimum wage to 3.75, we are being told, is an improvement which has no parallel since Gibraltarians started governing themselves, that is, since 1945. I almost thought he was going to tell us that it was in 1713 or 1704, but no. He will probably do that in his closing speech. Because having thought of it, he cannot possibly think that he is the most exceptional human being in that Gibraltar has produced only since 1945. There must be something wrong with that. He's been too modest. It must be at least since 1704, Mr. Speaker. The £3.75, if one is to believe the official statistics of the government employment survey, is hardly going to be obtained by anybody, because in the figures published by them, earnings in the employment survey, there was virtually nobody with a wage below 375 in October 1988. I do not know what it is that made October 98 the last employment survey tabled in the House, but if we look at the private sector distribution of earnings in terms of basic wages and overtime, which is detailed by sector, there is hardly anybody. In fact, the average is £4 or £3.90. And that does not include that there are some people below 375, but it is based on earnings. And the only people that I knew of that were earning less than 375 at the time were likely to be people like the security guards who got a pay increase as a result. That hardly qualifies for the adjectives that it was the most important advance we had seen in conditions of ordinary people since 1945, and that it benefited thousands and thousands of workers. Although the Chief Minister made no contribution to it, other ministers did recognize that, in fact, the biggest change that workers had experienced in Gibraltar was in the parity battle, which took 4 years and resulted in UK wages. To suggest that to put the minimum wage at 375 was to remove the differential treatment between industrial and non-industrial, all of which are welcome improvement, but not to say that they've not done a good thing, but it's certainly not the best thing since sliced bread or the best thing since the Second World War. The minimum wage, Mr. Speaker, was a flagship policy of the Labour Party in the UK during the successful 1997 campaign general election, and was introduced in April the 1st, 1999. The first rate was set at £3.60, an hour for adults aged over 22, covering then as many as 1.2 million adults who had an average pay of rise of 10%, which shows what wages were like for 1.2 million people in the UK. I have quoted how the Chief Minister of 2001 announced the change in the national minimum wage. And as I've demonstrated in my reply, it did not close any loopholes because there were no loopholes to close. There was no evidence of private sector employers moving people from weekly to monthly pay after 1989. And if that had been happening, then the union should have brought it to the attention of the government at the time that it was happening, and action would have been taken to stop it. The last increase under the GSLP was in November 1995. Mr. Neto was a minister in 1996, and he increased it in November 1996. He did nothing in 1996 to include the monthly pay or change the age, the so-called loopholes that he said he had discovered in 2015. They continued after 1996 until he stopped being Minister for Employment in 2001. Before 2001, he left being the Minister for Employment, and all these loopholes that he claims he closed, he didn't close, he let them open. It was the late Hubert Corby in 2001 who revoked the 1989 minimum wage order and replaced it by the new conditions announced in the budget. So Mr. Neto did not change the conditions, and in fact did not introduce any pay increases for 4 years. Very socialist, I am sure, Mr. Speaker. It enables him to give lectures to all the rest of us. Having dealt with these issues, I will now revert to the state of the economy. The economic challenge, and more particularly the public finance challenge of the combined effect of Brexit and the pandemic lockdown, is much, much worse than the challenges we faced as a people with the dockyard closure and the MOD rundown, and with the 1969 frontier closure. This is not just my opinion. The International Monetary Fund view in 2020 was that the COVID-19 pandemic pushed economies into a great lockdown, which helped contain the virus and save lives, but also triggered the worst recession since the Great Depression. It described the prospects as a crisis like no other in 2020 and an uncertain recovery in 2021. In our case, not only is the problem unprecedented, but finding a solution is particularly difficult. This is for two reasons, one external and another internal. The external reason is obvious. On both of those occasions in the past, the challenges we have faced were being faced exclusively by us. No other country was affected by the closure of the frontier, except a small percentage of the Spanish population in the Campo area, who finished up having to emigrate mostly to Germany and the UK. And in the second instance, it was only the UK who was affected in those other MOD dockyard towns who were also affected by cuts in the MOD budget. In both cases, the UK provided long-term financial help. The support and sustain policy introduced by the UK after the 1969 closure paid for almost all our capital investment. With the dockyard closure, there was 30 million provided by the UK for its conversion, and many MOD assets, especially land, was transferred for civilian use. On this occasion, the UK itself and much of the rest of the world are facing a huge drop in government revenues and are propping up their economies by issuing unprecedented levels of public debt. No country is any longer attempting to keep any given ratio of debt to GDP, especially in the last 18 months where global GDP has been shrinking and at the same time global public debt has been growing. So what is the internal reason for the obstacle? That's the external one that I've just explained. What's the internal one for the obstacle that we face today? It is the attitude that apparently exists in a large section of the electorate that the world owes us a living. I think the Honourable Mr. Fitton was the first one to call it the entitlement culture and say we had to do something about it. The evacuation generation did not have an entitlement culture, except on the issue that after the war we were entitled to be brought back home to Gibraltar. A campaign led by Sir Joshua Hassan, which resulted in lifelong following for the AACR. The close border generation did not have an entitlement culture. Led by Sir Bob Pelissa, they took on a second job to help Gibraltar keep going with the closed frontier, the two-job society, as some critics called it. The trade union battle for parity was a battle fought for the principle. And we said to the MOD at the time, if you give us more money, then we will reject it because it's a principle that we want. It's achieving the principle of parity with UK, to which we are still fully committed in this party. And the agreement produced from the payroll of the largest employer in Gibraltar at the time led to a secondary effect throughout the economy, a multiplier effect that helped us fight to survive the closed frontier. The 1988 transformation of the economy was not the result of an entitlement culture, but the opposite, the realization that we had to reinvent our economy and make it private sector led. It was indeed the Gibraltar government telephone department that led the way by voting in a secret ballot to accept leaving government employment and transfer to a joint venture which brought to Gibraltar the state-of-the-art technology that NYNEX possessed and created the necessary infrastructure for the financial services and the gaming companies that followed. A secret ballot of the membership was held with only one person voting against, and I gave that person a written undertaking that would guarantee his job in the public sector, which was honored subsequently by the GSD government. Today we do not appear to have that kind of solidarity and commitment, even though we are facing a European economy disrupted by Brexit and a global economy still in partial lockdown because of the ongoing pandemic, and perhaps most important of all, the need to relinquish consumerism that is related to the entitlement culture if life on earth is to survive. Today, Mr. Speaker, I will deliver my assessment of the economy of Gibraltar for the 47th time. My first was in 1973, and it was acknowledged by my dear friend Adolfo Garnier-Baden in government that it was not just my first time, it was the first time that an opposition member had provided an alternative analysis of both the economy and the public finances, in contrast to that of the Financial and Development Secretary, whose analysis had never previously been challenged and was taken as if it were written in tablets of stone up to 1973. The second occasion when I misput in my views to this House was in 2009, due to having to be absent from the budget debate for personal reasons. On that occasion, my colleague, the Chief Minister, described my absence as impoverishing the debate. He said, the Leader of the Opposition, when Chief Minister, was the first Chief Minister to deliver the speech on estimates himself as a politician and not allow those speeches to be given by the Financial and Development Secretary. Today would have marked his 37th speech in this House on these estimates since his first election in 1972. I am sure that whether the gentleman opposite agree with his analysis or not, the whole of the House will be poorer for the absence of his analysis. Well, he was sure, but he was wrong. Huh? The then Chief Minister obviously did not hold the same view of the value of the analysis that I had been putting in the House at budget time every year, and made it clear by saying, referring to my colleague, he started by saying the whole House was poorer for the absence of Mr. Bossano's analysis. Well, no, we do not agree. Only his side of the House is obviously poorer for the absence of Mr. Bossano's analysis. We do not agree with Mr. Bossano's annual analysis on the economy, and therefore his absence cannot therefore be poverty for us. But it must be clear to anybody that has had the debate on the budget this year how much poverty Mr. Bossano's absence as a leader of the opposition and leader of the GSLP results on that side of the House. We do not regret the absence of Mr. Bossano's analysis, although, of course, we regret his absence personally, and especially his reason for it. But we do not think we are poorer for the absence of his analysis. Since then, as opposition, they seem to now value the accuracy of my analysis slightly higher, or maybe a lot higher, which incidentally is not determined by who is in government, but by my interpretation of what the indicators are signaling in respect of how our economy is performing. And if this means being self-critical, so be it. None of us is perfect. We all make mistakes. That was in 2009. I will come back later to remind members what the GSD was up to in that year and what has some relevance, and which has some relevance to the questions surrounding the decision of the independent charity, Community Care, to restore the original conditions for payments to individuals linked to the role of delivering community duties, applicable when it was first introduced in 1992. The economic challenge, and more particularly the public finance challenge of a combined effect of Brexit and the pandemic lockdown, is much, much worse than the challenges we faced before. The position that we face now, we have to compare, Mr. Speaker, with the projections that I made in the 2015 general election, when I had projected that the economy would grow by at least to a level of 2.4 billion by 1920, with the possibility of achieving an economic output of 2.5 billion. Of course, in 2015, nobody could imagine what was going to happen in 2016. And even less what was to follow in 2020. I think Gibraltar must be the only nation on the planet where opposition members and sectors of the population behave as if these totally unprecedented events of Brexit and pandemic lockdown have no relevance for either the economy or the public finances, and we can all happily carry on as if we were, as we were doing before, as if we don't need to do anything other than blame the government, and then everything will turn out to be all right. In 2019, notwithstanding the 2016 Brexit vote, I predicted for 1920 a better result than the top estimate of 2015. A GDP level of 2.57 compared to 2.5 billion that I had originally set as the maximum, an improvement of 70 million. The latest estimate we have today, which was mentioned by the Chief Minister earlier, is that the economy attained a value of 2.566 billion in 1920. 66 million more than the top expectation that I had predicted in 2015, but 4 million short of the figure that I had calculated in 2019. In 2019, I also set a target for our growth for 23-24 of GDP at a level of 3 billion, representing an improvement of 390 million from the level of 2.61 billion, or 500 million from the original estimate of 2.5 billion. At present, we are looking at a baseline before the impact of the lockdown of 2.566 billion instead of 2.61, and a drop of 4.9% to 2.44 billion for the second half of the 24-month financial year period. This is instead of the projected 2.5% increase that I was saying we could achieve with the National Economic Plan, which would have put the GDP up from 2.61 billion to 2.68. So we are estimating, in terms of our performance of the economy as a result of March 21, that which is 60 million less in output than we were originally targeting without the pandemic lockdown. So in fact, in terms of the effect, it is less than one would expect given the seriousness of the lockdown. This level of difference in most nations' projected GDP would be considered an acceptable error in estimating, even without the pandemic. At question time, sometime back when the UK published a drop of 10% in the GDP, I told Parliament that I had no solid data to calculate the GDP impact, but that my gut feeling was that it would be less than the UK and could be half the UK rate. The estimate we now have is that we have done slightly better than that, with a drop of 4.9% instead of 5%. So our economy has done much better than others in the context of the projections we had for the prospective growth, but not the sort of growth we experienced in previous years. So does that mean we have no problems? On the contrary, Mr. Speaker, we have a very serious problem, because it clearly provides evidence of what I have identified as a problem of perception on innumerable occasions in the past. The size of the economy is not the same as the level of revenue that the government receives. Economic output is 60 million less than we expected, but our public finances have gone from surplus to a deficit of 158 million. Although a growing economy, as a general rule, produces a higher government revenue, this is not based on a fixed proportion. This is one of the errors that features as one of the factors maintaining the entitlement illusion, which now affects all members of the opposition as well. This phenomenon, which is that so long as you believe you are entitled to something, whether you are or not, and whether the money to pay for it is there or not, all you have to do is paint a few placards with what you believe you are entitled to, march up Main Street, and then after that, your entitlement illusion becomes reality and all your wishes and aspirations will be satisfied. Well, I'm afraid, Mr. Speaker, in the real world it doesn't work quite like that. And therefore, I can tell honorable members, it ain't going to happen. The Honorable Mr. Clinton may not understand much about economics, but presumably he does understand about finance, having been a banker, and he is a shadow member for the Minister of Finance. Indeed, he has given every indication that he does understand exactly how badly public finances have been hit by the lockdown. In public interviews that he's dealt with the subject, he has done so to such an extent that I don't think he could have explained it better if he had been in government. Indeed, I have even commented to my colleague, the Honourable Finance Minister, that the Honourable Member opposite was doing a better job of explaining him than it was. Which did not surprise me, since he has often been briefed on the financial impact in greater detail than I was. So when I say we can protect the economy of Gibraltar, and we can continue to grow, and that it is possible for me to aim at delivering the growth targets we set ourselves in 2019, I am not saying anything that indicates that the public finances are in a good shape, which manifestly they are not, just because the economy, in my view, is in good shape. In my new responsibility for restoring financial stability, which is closely linked to my previous responsibility for the public sector efficiency, I have, of course, a fundamental interest in ensuring that we maximize the use of our resources in the most efficient way possible so that we can restore the application of the Golden Rule that I introduced as Chief Minister after 1988. This, members know, is that living within our means requires that we do not borrow to meet operating costs of the public sector. We were there before the pandemic, and we're not there after the pandemic. And it's in the interest of every Gibraltarian citizen, in the public and the private sector, in education, employment, or retirement, that we get back there as soon as possible so that we can restore the stability that is vital for Gibraltar. In looking how that stability is reflected in our economy, we need to analyze what is happening in the labor market. The period covering the two employment surveys which you have available in this budget gives us a snapshot of the labor market as it was in October 19 and October 20. I think it is useful to see the changes from October 11 to October 18, and then see the effect of Brexit and the pandemic lockdown in 19 and 20. The 24-month period, which has hit public revenue so hard, has created a new labor context of the planning of the economy. When we prepared the post-Brexit National Economic Plan, we were expecting the labor market would continue to grow in line with recent trends and produce a total employment figure of around 32,000. In the post-Brexit scenario, we expected that the economy would be reshaped by us to produce less labor-intensive work. We therefore planned that the future market for the 4 years, 2019, to 2023, should be stabilized at a maximum size of 32,000 jobs, and that future economic growth should be delivered by increasing productivity from a static workforce rather than an ever-increasing workforce as had been the case previously, and which could not be extrapolated to continue indefinitely. Even though we left the EU at midnight on the 31st of December 2020 and the free movement of labour and the EU law no longer exists, the degree to which we shall be controlling the labour market is still pending the outcome of what is agreed in the proposed treaty on our relationship with Schengen. The EU will be setting out their terms, and we shall see whether in negotiation after that an agreement acceptable to us can be reached. Should there be no deal, we will be in the hard Brexit scenario that I have been suggesting would be the most probable outcome since the result of the 2016 referendum was announced. And there is no doubt in my mind that we will be there already and we would have been a long time ago if Margallo had remained in office. The treaty's outcome in the next 6 months will put pressure on the labor market as regards dependence on frontier workers. Our dependence on that source of labor has to start declining, since if we have an agreement at this stage, it may not survive the so-called implementation period, if Spain and the EU expect Frontex to be removed and Spanish officials to take over 4 years after the treaty comes into effect. The Honourable Mr. Clinton said, once we go down the route of customs union, it will be difficult to undo, and we may have lost business, says, and business opportunities and some freedom and control in managing our economy. There has to be a clear-cut economic case that joining the customs union in whatever form will either prevent a loss of business without crossing the red lines of sovereignty, jurisdiction and control. This discussion has to be open and frank. At present, there are conflicting figures as to the number of frontier workers between the numbers registered by the ETV and those declared by the employers in response to the October employment survey. The ETV figures of the 31st of December 20 were compiled to establish who will be enjoying continuing labour market access in accordance with the withdrawal agreement. Mr. Speaker, I agree with the view expressed by the Honourable Member, but I think I need to point out that, in fact, we are not asking to have a customs union, and as far as I know, no, we are not being offered a customs union. The relevance of seeking some understanding or agreement or derogation is so that the movement of personal purchases doesn't stop the queues that no longer exist because we're in Schengen, because at the end of the day, every time somebody comes in and buys something from Morrison, or every time somebody goes into La Line and buys something there, he has to go through customs, and there's a queue on the customs side, then in effect, one thing would have been negating the other. And I think it is, whether such a thing is possible, we don't know, but that is what we're talking about. What we're talking about is not, if we manage to do the first, not then find that the second negates the first, because then the whole exercise would have been worthless. We still would have a situation of people having long queues to go in both directions. The market for labour is likely to be stable or declining from now on, but this does not mean that there will be the same people doing the same work, because as in the past, turnover has always been higher than the net increase. So we always had the situation, which has been a very large figure, of many people leaving every year and more people coming in than left. And that is because it's in some instances the kind of work that had this high turnover was work where people don't go in for a long time in the tourist industry. For example, the labour market figure that we use for calculating the GDP and therefore planning the economy has always been the figure in the employment survey reports. Since these are the numbers reported by employers, they are likely to be accurate or, if anything, conservative, as it's unlikely that employers will be recording workers they don't have, although they may be under-recording some of those that they do have. The size of our labour market consisted of 22,247 jobs in October 2011. This is the full-time and part-time figure, but not necessarily 22,247 individuals, since there will be persons who will be holding two jobs, although it is not likely to be significant statistically. The public sector was 4,574, and the balance was the MOD and the private sector. This is in October 11. The private sector, which is what concerns us now in the context of the policy on the labor market, was 16,960 in 11, up from 15,561, an increase of 1,399 in October 2007. The last term of the GSD administration saw a growth in the private sector of 1,399 jobs, from 15,561 to 16,960. In October 18, the figure for the private sector was 23,969, compared to 19,690, an increase of 7,009 individuals in 7 years, compared to 1,404. The increase was higher than that, in fact, when compared to 2012, since in our first year there was a drop of 1,116 jobs. And our first year in government resulted in the figure falling, and we, if we compare, therefore, with the figure of 15,844 from 2012 to 2018, then it went up every year, and there was a total increase in 6 years of 8,125 persons taking up employment in Gibraltar. The drop from 11 to 12 in the private sector frontier workers was from 7,287 to 6,189, a total of 1,099. The public sector in turn lost 79, making the total more than the contraction in the jobs market, which in fact meant that we had lost more frontier workers than we had lost jobs, and therefore some of the previous frontier jobs, worker jobs, had been taken by resident workers. There was a slight increase in the use of resident workers because we lost more resident workers than we lost jobs in that time. This was reversed from 2012 to 2018. Frontier workers more than doubled in the private sector, from 6,189 to 13,371, providing 7,182 workers of the increased demand for labor of 8,125 jobs, which was what happened up to 2018, before the world changed. By contrast with this higher expansion in the private sector, from 2018 to 2019, it only grew by 32 jobs. And shrank from 2019 to 2020 by 1,214 jobs. The frontier workers for 2019, however, grew from 13,371 in 2018 to 13,839 in 2019, an increase of 468. This implies a net growth of 32 jobs meant, against a net jobs, a net increase of 32 jobs meant a replacement of 436 resident workers by the same number of frontier workers. So we had 32 more jobs in the private sector, but we brought in 468 more workers. So it meant that 436 jobs less were held by residents. This is entirely consistent with the fact that the public sector grew in 2018 to 2019 by 593 jobs. And that of this, 437 came from the private sector and were replaced by frontier workers. Quite frankly, this is not good for the sustainability of the public sector or the security of the private sector that becomes more dependent on frontier worker fluidity as a result. From October 19 to October 20, the number of jobs in the private sector fell by 1,240. The workers, the frontier workers in the private sector dropped from 13,839 to 12,571, a total of 1,268, which implies, again, as had happened before, that resident workers in the private sector went up by 54. The correlation between the movement in the public sector and the private and the frontier workers in the private sector lend support to the complaint of private sector employers that the demand from the public sector forces them to have to recruit frontier workers as replacement. The evidence is there. Whereas the private sector reduced its dependence on frontier workers in 2020 by reducing the number by 1 to 6, the public sector saw an increase in the number by 57, with the biggest element being those designated as other EU nationals. It is possible that this increase was not due to more people being employed in the public sector, but employees living in Spain previously using a Gibraltar address, which they were forced to change due to the controls at the frontier during the pandemic, and later departure from the EU. So it meant that people who were supposed to be living here but were living there had to give their real address because, you know, they were facing problems getting home at night. The frontier workers registered in Gibraltar at the end of December was a much larger figure than the number registered in the survey returns by the employers, and this, of course, will need to be scrutinized as we go on during the year to ascertain the accuracy of the figure for economic planning purposes. Another new area that I have been made responsible for recently, Mr. Speaker, is the financial stability responsibility, which I have been entrusted by the Chief Minister with the task of restoring financial stability, which was not part of my responsibilities in the last budget 2 years ago. However, in practice, it is closely linked to the policy of increasing efficiency in the public sector, for which I was responsible already. I have said, when my additional responsibility was announced, that we had lost financial stability because by definition and by the determining criterion, stability in public finances requires the implementation of the GSLP golden rule introduced by me after 1988 in the first socialist government. And for many years, financial stability has been maintained because it requires balancing income with expenditure in respect of recurrent spending in the public sector and preferably providing a surplus to fund, in our case, principally three areas: investment in the creation of capital assets, which the GSD also did between 1996 and 2011, contributing to the finances of the independent charity Community Care Limited and building a rainy day fund, which the DSD did not do between 1996 and 2011, and which indeed they rubbished as soon as they were elected in 1996, when the Chief Minister of the time announced in this House, "The rainy day is today," and emptied what he called all my piggy banks. This, of course, left Gibraltar more exposed to losing its financial stability than it would otherwise have been as a result. So restoring stability, in our book, requires keeping a tight control on spending. Such decisions are taken by the cabinet, which decides the policy of the government, although I tend to be the one blamed if there is a negative reaction resulting from some measures. The Chief Minister has recently told the House and the general public that we have been doing so badly we have been so badly hit in our revenues by the pandemic lockdown and the extra public health COVID measures that we have finished up with a deficit of 158 million, million. The largest deficit in Gibraltar's history, but a similar situation to that experienced by many other countries in Europe and by the US, who, incidentally, have never implemented our golden rule on recurrent expenditure, and where in many cases they have been regularly running recurrent account deficits and borrowing to cover it. This year's budget reflects the need to restore this stability. As the Chief Minister also announced in an earlier meeting, the result projected for the current financial year is a deficit of 51 million, almost a million a week. Let's be clear what this means. The projected expenditure is expected to exceed the projected revenue by £1 million every week starting on the 1st of April. So anybody who wants more, that is not in that book, wants us to either cut somebody else's allocation or borrow more than £1 million a week. It's simple to understand. This is not a complex exercise. Total departmental expenditure is 46.5 million more than the actual expenditure of 1890, compared to the annual averages of 69.5 in each of the 12 months in the preceding 24-month period. So although we are still up on 1819, we're less up than we were in the last 24 months, partly because there's a lot of expenditure there, of course, which is not being repeated, and because of the measures we've taken. The government is nonetheless committed to restoring financial stability, which means getting back to projecting recurrent levels of spending that come in at or below the expected levels of income. To achieve our target for this year will not be easy, and therefore a number of policies have been implemented that required cabinet approval to be obtained before expenditure is incurred. This is how it should be, but in the past it has frequently been the case that the cabinet position on approving additional spending had been a paper exercise since the spending had already taken place. This is not a new phenomenon, and indeed I remember one particular issue with the GHA spending, which was on relief cover, which was removed from the budget of the GHA by the GSD administration so that the allocation would not be accessible without the prior approval of the Chief Minister's office in an attempt to keep control of the item, an attempt which, if I remember correctly, eventually ended in failure to achieve the desired result, as so many attempts do. The elimination of waste in the procurement process is also something that requires to be looked into. There is a tendency for departments to simply reorder supplies by repeating periodically what has been ordered in the past. It is an area that may not yield the kind of savings we are looking for, but we have to be conscious and become conscious that every penny counts, and we have not been there for a very long time. The mindset that has been created is that every year, without much effort, the revenue of the government goes up, and the expenditure goes up as well, as if that was the natural order of things. It has not always been like that. But I accept that there are many people who have never known anything else and will need to get used to the new normal. A recent press release from the Honourable Ladies Party said something to the effect that revenue was not increased under the present government, and that this can only mean that whoever wrote the press release has never looked at the estimate book. Revenue increased from 383 million in March 2011 to 708 million in March 2019. 8 years produced a growth in revenue of £325 million. There has been an increase in revenue in many areas without any increase in what people are charged, simply because there have been more activity in the economy. What we have had in the last 2 years has not been what was normal, but what could become the new normal, and what may require the government to look in future to new areas where revenue can be raised. A real test in the 9 months ahead is to contain expenditure so that it finishes no higher than the amounts we're approving this week. We need to establish as a standard the notion that an increase in cost in one area must be matched by saving in another. The departmental spending in the future should be constrained by accepting that the overall priority is that we have, as a community, to consider what is the most important expenditure from the limited resources we're going to have, so that they should be devoted to those areas. This is how the public judges us when they criticize the government for spending money in one area and then having to say no to something else which is more deserving of public funding. It happens to every government. It has happened to us. And the people are right when they criticize us for it. It also means that since we have to borrow 1 million a week to cover costs, it's more important than ever to spend money on things that cannot wait for better times ahead, which I have no doubt will come when we think of what we're going to do when we come to the rest of the elements in the economy. Keeping the economy on an even keel is something that I am confident we can do in terms of the modest level of growth we are committed to. A target in the output of our economy of £3 billion for the end of financial year 23-24 is what we aimed for in 2019, and achieving it is still possible. However, restoring revenue levels to what it was in the past is not going to be easy. I have already said previously that I do not expect to see the revenue level we attained in 2018-19, which was the highest ever, £708 million. I will not expect that before the next election, and perhaps not even for some time after. So the financial strategy we need will therefore require inevitably that we should address the efficient use of resources to contain expenditure, looking at what we charge for the services we provide, and where, in many instances, what we provide is being provided at a loss. In considering the efficient use of resources, we cannot ignore the size and the cost of the public sector payroll. The Chief Minister has given figures that shows that although we are committed by our manifesto to maintain the number in the complement of civil servants that we inherited in 2011, in actual practice, currently there are many more in employment, and that the complement is now far exceeded by the numbers of employees. The numbers employed in the public service have also grown substantially since 2011, not just in the civil service. It cannot go up any further, and indeed it will have to start coming down, but not by dismissing anybody, but by redeploying people to meet changing requirements in the service, and doing this is not austerity, but good management. The opposition have criticized us when it was increasing, and criticizes when it stopped increasing. In our first term, Mr. Fiedem, in a debate, accused me of having created a bloated civil service in the first few months, when we were still filling vacancies created by them. The GSD had a system of keeping vacancies on hold and recruiting over a period of time, and then opening them up in a pre-election boost to improve their chances of winning the election. We continued their pre-election recruiting for the first 4 years and added an extra 400 employees. When we put a stop to it after the 2015 election, we were accused by the same Mr. Fiedem, who had said we were creating a bloated civil servant, of introducing austerity. Based on the numbers in the employment survey report for 2020 and 2011 and the subsequent recruitment of 94 AAs, since last October, we will be talking probably of something like 1,800 more employees than in October 2011. And this is something that must be understood. Controlling the number of jobs in the public sector is the only way we or any other government can protect the jobs of those that are in employment now and in the future. Every time somebody leaves, we need to ask ourselves, do we really need to take somebody on to do the same job? And if we find that we don't, then the next question is, how can we use that money to, and how can we put it to better use? That is not austerity. That is a managing one's budget the old-fashioned way, before the culture of entitlement became the norm. It is something that controlling officers should be doing over time, because they're not there simply to control what has been approved by this parliament, but to make sure that in a world of changing methodology and new technology, that we are delivering the services we need in the most cost-effective way. Restoring financial stability, Mr. Speaker, is not rocket science. It is simply politically difficult because it involves becoming unpopular for doing what is required, doing the right thing that has to be done in the long-term interest of the public service and securing the future of our country so that we depend on no one. We must develop the capacity to be competitive, to earn a living that will enable us to maintain the quality and the breadth of services that we have become used to having until now. The antithesis of financial stability is a culture of entitlement. So what is the culture of entitlement? Well, perhaps the first indication of a culture of entitlement, the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition may remember this, was a self-granted pay increase on the 17th of December 1998, which was presented to this House in the first DSD term. Something they had not bothered to put in their manifesto, incidentally, during the election campaign. The government had first granted the Financial and Development Secretary a 25% increase, and then they followed by linking their pay to the new enhanced salary, giving themselves a higher percentage than was the case in respect of the old salary. As leader of the opposition, I pointed out that when salaries had previously been reviewed, Sir Joshua Hassan had first discussed it with Peter Isola, the leader of the opposition, and myself as the sole representative of the GSLP in 1980. The GSD had decided that it should be done by them alone, without any consultation. The reply from the then Chief Minister was that by bringing a motion to the House and the fact that we could speak, he actually allowed us to speak in those days, and vote against the motion, it meant we were being consulted. That's what he said, it's in the Hudson. It's worth remembering what the definition of consultation was with the GSD government, Mr. Speaker. The basic argument for the need to introduce much higher salaries, which reflected the values of the GSD, were explained by the Chief Minister of the day as follows. He said, "The fact of the matter is that it is the government's view that if, as Gibraltar must, in its long-term interest, if Gibraltar is going to attract into the field of politics and through the field of politics into those ventures people of the right caliber to govern Gibraltar, they have got to be paid adequately. Either by people who have, otherwise Gibraltar will be condemned to be governed either by people who have enough private capital to do it on a charitable vocational basis, in other words, the stinking rich," he said, "or those people for whom a salary of £27,000 amounts to an improvement in their salary," which of course was the case with most of opposition members when they were ministers. It is a rule of the government that it is not in Gibraltar's interest for the categories of people who can afford to go into politics should be limited to that. The point is to give the electorate the choice of every category and not to use, quite wrongly, the system of remuneration to keep competition out until eventually people offer themselves, regardless of the conditions, to do something about it. The honourable members, meaning us, suppose he had no choice but to call us honourable, are entitled to their views, which of course are as respectable, I am sure, meaning he wasn't, as our own. But I have not heard it articulated anywhere in Western Europe that those that govern should somehow not be paid a full and proper salary because there is something romantic, a value underlying, underpaying them, because somehow that demonstrates their commitment to the people and it demonstrates their sense of sacrifice and their sense of commitment to the affairs over which they're responsible. I would point out, Mr. Speaker, I'm coming now to my voice, that although he tried to wriggle out of it later, the implication of what he had said was clear. This was at the beginning of the term. His message was that the existing system could only attract the filthy rich who were bored and were entering politics as a hobby, or the ignorant poor who would see it as an opportunity to get a pay rise. He went on to say that the second category was the one that applied to the GSD ministers in the previous administration. He argued that the word ignorant was my interpretation. Well, if it was not ignorant, in what respect were the GSLP government of 1988 to 1996 made up of people of low caliber, attracted to becoming involved in politics in order to get the pay rise, because we had no expectation of being able to earn £27,000 otherwise. One person who was probably better off at that point in time was Minister Neto, who I suppose the GSD would have considered as a low-caliber candidate. But I don't know if that was also the attribute that they applied to Peter Montegrifo or to the Honourable Mr. Sopardi, who were also part of the team. Perhaps they were the filthy rich. Yeah, the filthy rich were bored. There were only two categories, filthy rich or poor caliber. Mr. Speaker, in 1998, when I pointed out that the normal way we set guidelines in this House was by reference to getting advice from the House of Commons, as had been the case for the members' remuneration in 1979, the response from the Chief Minister was that by wanting to bring an expert from the UK, I was undergoing a sudden conversion on the road to Damascus in 1998. There seems to be an urban myth within the GSD that I am constantly making trips to Damascus. Caliber might be the yardstick that the GSD has used in selecting their candidates over the subsequent years, although I cannot say that I have seen any spectacular improvements over the years. I would not be expecting this for the GSLP, since it does not classify people in terms of caliber, but in terms of political conviction and commitment to the defense of Gibraltar against any possible attempt by Spain to take us over. The qualities that the GLP requires from all its potential candidates. Those values and those convictions are not swayed by the size of the pay envelope. But the new value system that the GSD wanted to attract into politics people of caliber is a measure of how much some people need to be paid to be attracted by the opportunity of being involved in guiding our country's future. If it's a question of caliber, political ideology is not relevant in that system. It becomes just another job which pays well and allows you to lord it over your fellow citizens, which in the case of the then chief minister clearly was what gave him his adrenaline rush. So if ministers only do a good job if they are paid enough money, why should anybody else in the public service be any different? That was the seed that led to the dismantling of the parity basis for relativity in the public sector that has had such a negative effect on the total cost of the public payroll. The introduction of the parity principle, which was seriously undermined, enabled people to accept pay differentials between different groups and trades on the basis that the rule was that you were being paid this for doing the same work as in UK, in the public sector, for better or for worse. Since then, with every departure from UK analogue, the culture of entitlement has grown by discontent with the creation of internal relativities peculiar to Gibraltar. Why should a police constable earn a higher pay at the lower part of an SEO and not an S? Who is more valuable in our society? Well, it depends if we're in the middle of a crime wave or in the middle of a pandemic. How can such a system endure without being constantly affected by never-ending leapfrogging claims which people feel entitled to have met? It was what used to be the norm in the 1970s and was banished by the UK parity determining the acceptable relativities. If someone is happy at getting £50,000, he becomes unhappy if he sees a fellow worker about overtaking him and jumping above, going from £50,000 to £70,000. It happened with the GSD in government and has continued since, and it is very difficult to put an end to. The culture of entitlement grew under the GSD, was inherited by us in 2011 and has been growing since. And its most recent and worst example was at the beginning of this month. On Wednesday, the 30th of June, the GSD in general, and the Honourable Mr. Clinton in particular, was condemning the increase in contributions who will be paid as from this month and go to restore the finances of the Statutory Benefits Fund. The payments, as I said in my interview, by the way of example, show that 30,000 workers pay insurance contributions and fund the old age pension of some 6,000 pensioners. Failure to raise contribution means having to borrow money and subsidize pensions which contributors of the past have earned with the contributions that went to pay pensioners of their time in the pay-as-you-go system we inherited in 2011. But not the 1996 model, which was to hold reserves that provided investment income and made pension funding less vulnerable and less dependent on the size of the labour market and the level of insurance payments. The next day, on the 1st of July, the GSD members of Parliament participated in a demonstration which is calling for payments to persons who receive tax-free occupational pensions in excess of £21,000, predominantly retired government employees, mainly in the previously highly paid employment with civil service non-contributory final salary pension schemes, which they, the GSD in government, shut down in 2011. This demand, the demo organizer says, is to be backdated, as if the charity had to make payments to persons in need and had a legal obligation to pay anyone anything, and must continue non-means testing payments until the old age pension for men is brought from 65 down to 60. Introducing such a change, which members support, is to increase the cost of what would be the payment of an old age pension to five times as many men as is the case until now. So if we did what the opposition wanted us to do in supporting the demonstration, we would be paying pensions from the Statutory Benefit Fund, which has no money, to men reaching this year the ages of 65, 64, 63, 62, 61, and 60. All this year, and at the same time, according to the stance of the day before, we have to make no increase in the payment of insurance contributions, which the legislation provides has to pay for the pensions. The policy of the members opposite, who have previously opposed borrowing to create assets and fund fixed capital formation, even though they did it in government, but they opposed it in opposition, now we are going to have to do to pay recurrent expenditure. Well, is that what they would do if they were in government? Would they be borrowing at this stage to pay pensioners from the age of 60? The rest of Europe, which like us faces an aging and longer living population, is going in the opposite direction and raising women's pensionable age to 67 and not reducing men's pensionable age to 60. I have to tell my good friend Roy Clinton that I'm disappointed that he should have participated in this blatantly obvious farce which destroys any credibility he might have, and indeed did have, in my eyes, for commitment to prudential public finance policy. How can we be prudent in reducing the age for pensioners, in not raising contributions, and in borrowing more money than the money we're having to borrow already of a million a week? The GST, Mr. Speaker, has blown hot and cold on the question of public expenditure and the entitlement culture to the point of being almost psychotic. I have also recently undertaken the additional responsibility as Minister for Social Security, and my first responsibility was to put into effect an increase in Social Security payments which had not been previously raised since 2018. Mr. Clinton made the point in the public statement that it was the first act I did in my additional duties. I hope that that does not mean that he believes or is trying to persuade others to believe that the reason for increasing is the fact that I've been given the responsibility for Social Security, which of course it is not. It is a decision that is the implementation of the policy of the government, with which I entirely agree, of course, but would have been done whoever was the minister. The rates of social insurance contributions are not government revenue, as every member of this House knows. The money that is paid in social insurance contributions goes directly into the health authority as to 70% and directly into statutory benefits fund as to 30%. This has always been the case, except in one particular year when the GSD broke the legal limit for the maximum public debt, and to restore the ratio they retrospectively legislated for the contribution to go into the consolidated fund and out of the consolidated fund before it went to the GHA. And it has continued since then like that. The Social Insurance Pension Fund has been facing a potential crisis similar to the one faced by the revalued pensions for pre-69 frontier workers for years without the issue being addressed by the GSD. I will give some details of the pre-69 frontier workers situation later on. The statutory benefits fund, Mr. Speaker, the current version of the social insurance fund, has since its creation received the social insurance contributions. These are not taxes, have never been taxes, and have never been credited to the consolidated fund. I hope the Honourable Lady by now understands how this works, and that the statement from Together Gibraltar, which says the opposite, reflects the ignorance of whoever wrote it and not hers. I will read the statement and demonstrate its inaccuracy. The statement says, Together Gibraltar says the government's recently announced increase in social insurance payments amounts to a regressive tax. Actually, it's not regressive and it's not a tax. And damages an already battered private sector, adding any such measures should have involved consultation with the Federation of Small Businesses and the Chamber of Commerce. In a statement of the changes which set out to come in force. On the 1st of July, the opposition party says it believes that given the damaging effects the pandemic has had on the ROC's enormity, it is not the time to increase social insurance payments. But yes, to increase social insurance pensions, of course, that goes without saying. Together, Gibraltar says that the government's assertion that those on the minimum wage will not be affected is disingenuous, and as a rise will affect a large number of employees in the bracket only marginally higher, adding those numbers are especially high in the most troubled sectors such as retail, wholesale and hospitality. It also describes this ingenious my argument that social insurance payments are used to pay pensions and health care, arguing that most government revenue is collected into one pot and therefore if any expenses in health care happen to exceed the revenue from social insurance, the government could source funds from other pots, parts of the budget, a budget which is in deficit, of course. A tax, Mr. Speaker, for those who don't know what it is something we all pay to finance the provision of the public services and pays for the salaries of public servants, government contractors, and procurement of supplies. With social insurance, if you do not pay, you do not receive a pension. The more contributions that you pay, the higher pensions that you get. These are not the characteristics of a tax. These are insurance premia, just as if you contribute to an occupational pension scheme. If you don't pay your taxes, you may get prosecuted. But if there is a fire in your house, the fire brigade will come and put it out, notwithstanding that you haven't paid your taxes. I hope this assists Together Gibraltar to understand the difference. Not only is it not a tax, it just cannot be regressive if it is a percentage of earnings, because the higher the earning, the higher the contribution. Though the cap can be said to be regressive, and that is what has been made less regressive by the increase. There are, according to the employment survey reports, 29,516 employee jobs, of which 18,105 are above the cap and would pay more if the cap was at a higher level than the £363 weekly income. Of the 11,411 with incomes below £363 a week, 4,089 are between the minimum wage and the £363 and are affected by the increase in the cap. Okay? So, where the cap increase affects 4,089 and there are 7,322 at the minimum wage or below because they work less hours and have lower earnings. That group is not affected by the increase in the cap. That group gets a pay rise by the increase on the minimum wage and they pay more insurance because they have a higher pay. They would have paid the same higher level of insurance if there had been no movement in the cap. The increase in the voluntary contribution eliminates the regressive nature of this contribution, where the amount paid was lower than the rate paid by employees who were cross-subsidizing the persons making the voluntary contributions, because the workers are paying the £36. And the payment by the people who are paying voluntary contribution was £15 and has now been put at the same rate as the workers are paying. At the previous rate of payment, the volunteer contribution, if we compare it with, for example, the purchase of an annuity to understand how good or bad of an investment it was the equivalent of being able to buy an annuity that gave a rate of 22%. And at the increased rate, the comparable rate on an annuity would be delivering a return of 9%. The best annuities that you can get in the United Kingdom now produce a return of 5%. So even at the new rate, there's a 9% return on your money in what you're going to get in higher pensions, and before you are getting a 22% return on your money on what you are getting at £15. In terms of what it buys in pension increases, this depends on how many employee contributions have already been paid. With the lower number of contributions already paid, the higher the benefit obtained. At the old rate of voluntary contributions, the contributor would get his money back from a higher pension within a time range between 6 months and 5.5 years. So he pays his £15, and when he gets his pension, 6 months later, he's already got his £15 back, if he's got very few contributions. So the average is the figure that I gave before of the percentages, and this is the range between the people who benefit most and the people who benefit least. The more stamps you've already paid, the less effect the ones you buy have, clearly. The position with the new rate is that instead of 6 months and 5.5 years, they will get their money back in a period which ranges from 1 year to 13 years. Since almost everybody's expectation now with the present life expectation for men is that when you retire at 65, you've still got 15 or 20 years in front of you, nobody will lose money by paying this contribution at the rate that it is now. There are 232 voluntary contributors out of the 18,000 or whatever it is currently, and I've asked the department to do an exercise to see what their personal circumstances are, to consider if any adjustment is required in any individual case. Any new voluntary contributor will be paying the new rate. The Social Insurance Fund has been having serious problems of long-term funding as currently structured. This has been the view of the GSLP for a long time, Mr. Speaker, and explains why we are committed to deliver a new social insurance scheme in which the ages of the beneficiaries would be equalized, which is what our manifesto says. The new scheme cannot be prepared, let alone delivered, until we know what our relationship with the EU will be as a result of the Schengen Access Agreement. If there is an element that deals with the social security arrangements for EU workers, then it will mean that what we're able to do will be constrained, as opposed to what would be the case if such a condition is no longer applicable. We are not going to do anything until we can deliver a system that will protect future generations, which is a responsible approach to take on what is a long-term intergeneration issue. At present, young people still working pay for the pensions of those who are retired. That is not a system that can survive, and it is not how the scheme was intended to work initially. I illustrated in a recent example that I gave that as it stands at present, every additional pensioner added to the expenditure requires 5 new workers added to the workforce to contribute the revenue. Or if the increasing the number of workers is not happening, as is the case now, then it would mean that future increases in contributions would have to be higher by the remaining working population. The future of the pensions provisions that we make that are statutory is linked and has been linked since 1989 with the community care. So I will now deal with the issues of community care and aspiring community officers. The role of community care in protecting the standard of living of our senior citizens seems to have been forgotten by members opposite, in spite of the fact that in government the party they represented acted in a totally disgraceful way, pretending to uphold the survival of the charity whilst planning its demise, as was revealed for the first time in an interview published in the Chronicle on Thursday, the 17th of July, 2010. I quote what the then Chief Minister said. For example, on pensions and community care, the complete abuse of a statement by the leader of Devotion, me, that the government was allowing community care to run out of money, completely abuse to say that. He did not say that as a matter of bookkeeping. He said that to transmit to the elderly the view that community care payments might be in jeopardy, which he knows to be complete and utter lie. But did he have any reluctance to worry elderly people in Gibraltar? No. It has been the government's policy for 15 years. 15 years of promising in this house to protect community care, and 15 years of a policy being implemented to run down the fund of community care, the lie that I'm supposed to be saying. So that he says we can make alternative and better arrangements, and we welcome the better arrangements. But we don't know where they are. He says, does that mean that anybody's payments are going to be in jeopardy? No. So he's telling us it's got better alternatives, better arrangements, and everybody is going to be paid the same as they were paid before. Okay. I know that they have since then disowned the policy of getting rid of community care whilst in opposition and after 2011. But they spent from 1996 to 2009 denying whilst in government their plan to close down community care. That is, until they owned up and admitted that they had been planning and doing it from 1996 to 2010. I also know that they frequently claim that they are not responsible for the actions of the GSD in government, except when it suits them, as was recently the case when Mr. Osino, who aspires to be the next leader of the GSD, told Parliament that he was proud of the GSD's record on tourism as if he had had anything to do with it. I will not set out to demonstrate that even in that area there was little done to be particularly proud of, because what I want to establish is simply that the link with the past performance of the G is there when it suits them. Much of what I'm about to say now is and was in the public domain already. And of course, because of my long involvement, I sometimes take it for granted that others in this parliament or outside it, while organizing petitions, know the past and choose to ignore it. However, it is quite possible that there are people out there who have no idea of the past and are making false statements out of ignorance rather than malice. And I am prepared to give them the benefit of the doubt, Mr. Speaker, by putting the record straight. It is also the case that much of what happened in the past in relation to the funding of social insurance old age pension is very relevant to understanding what is happening now and what the future may hold. The creation of an old age pension scheme was the work of the AACR government in 1955, following on from the United Kingdom National Insurance Act of 1948. At a later stage, collection for the group practice medical scheme contributions was added. The Old Age Pension Act was passed and created a scheme that was always intended to be self-funded, with revenues kept separate from the consolidated fund and legally held for the purpose of the Act and not available to government to be used for any other purpose. The requirement of the Social Insurance Fund was subject to periodical actuarial reviews, usually 5 years, to establish the level of contribution that was needed to maintain its self-sufficiency and generate a surplus as such that would create a reserve which was considered by the actuary to be at least the equivalent of 1 year's estimated payments. That would be over £30 million now. That was considered to be the prudential level of reserves. So those who say that this is a simple tax that the government can use for whatever they want do not know what they're talking about. Given that the same system has been in place for 66 years, there is no excuse for not knowing this. It was precisely because it was not part of the consolidated fund, where all the taxation receipts gone, that there was a special fund and a Spanish sub-fund made up of the contributions made by the withdrawn frontier workers with payments from 1955 to 1969. The total amount contributed by each worker was of the order of £38 each in the whole of the 14 years. Under 38, actually. Based on their contributions, on paying the £38, they were then entitled for the rest of their life after retirement to a maximum weekly pension of £1 a week for a single person and £1.50 for a married couple. These were exactly the same benefits payable to Gibraltarians with the same contributions at the same time. In 1973, the Social Insurance Ordinance was amended to give annual pension increases for those contributors who continue to work in Gibraltar and pay social insurance. The contribution rates and the pension payable for this second category was raised every year. The Spanish workers did not contribute because they had been withdrawn by the Franco government. The government of Sir Robert Pelissa offered to transfer the accumulated fund of the Spanish workers, which was estimated to be about 4.5 million, and their accrued rights to the Spanish government. Well, no, it was 4.5 million much later. At that time, it would have been much less. At the beginning, it would have been probably 1 million or 1.5. But this offer was rejected by Franco and criticized by the AECR opposition, who then, when they were in government, tried to do the same thing as Bob Pelissa and offered it to the Spanish government, and that was also rejected. The 1973 amendment, which was made by the AECR, however, provided for pension increases for resident workers in Gibraltar who had not contributed to the pension fund at the new increased rates post-1969. So we had the post-1969 contributions being increased after 1973 and providing increased pensions and increased payments for people who were retiring with 1973 contributions. People who had retired with pre-93 contributions, in the case of the Spaniards, pre-69, in the case of the Gibraltarians, between 69 and 73 as well, were getting the pension at the old rates, the rates that had never been increased. The number of Gibraltarian pensioners in this category, claiming on the basis of residence, because they didn't have more contributions in the new system, was minute. In 1985, the frontier was reopened following the implementation of the Brussels Agreement. The Spanish government informed Spanish pensioners at the time that they would be able to collect their social insurance pensions at the 1969 rate of £1 from February 1985, and that this would be revalued to the level payable to resident pensioners in January 1986 when Spain joined the European Union. The GSLP, in opposition, had proposed confidentially to the government that the social insurance ordinance be restructured to avoid the liability that would arise and which the fund was incapable of meeting. The government of Gibraltar under Sir Joshua Hazard rejected the advice, the solution on the advice of Sir David Haney, who told him it would go against the EU law. This advice was incorrect. Sir David Haney was Margaret Thatcher's Mr. Europe, Joshua Hassan told me. How could I know more than him? Well, I didn't know more than him, but I knew in whose interest I was working, and that was Gibraltar and not the UK's. In December 1985, at the Brussels negotiating sessions in Madrid, even though the ACR was saying in motions here in this house that there was no connection with Brussels on the pensions saga, Sir Geoffrey Howe agreed with his Spanish counterpart to pay revalued pensions to former Spanish workers from the 1st of January 1986. They had not previously cleared this with Sir Joshua Hassan, who was present at the negotiations, and who issued a public statement subsequently refusing to accept responsibility for this. An agreement was reached with UK by the AECR, under which consultants were engaged to produce a report to examine how the Gibraltar social insurance scheme could be refinanced to meet the liability. And ODA contributed some £15 million to meet the payments for the period from 1986 to 1988, when another election was due and we were expected to win. So it would become our problem. The GSLP included a manifesto commitment in that election that it would not contribute one penny of Gibraltar's money to finance Spanish revalued pensions and campaigned in the 98 elections on this basis and won on this basis. The consultant's report, commissioned by the UK, simply came up with the self-evident conclusion that the liability running then at £8 million a year could be met by large increases in income tax or social insurance to be paid by the Gibraltarians. Immediately after the election, I held meetings with Baroness Choca, Linda Choca, a very good friend of mine, subsequently, the minister responsible for Gibraltar, and this was the first policy conflict of many over the pensions with the UK government. The amount allocated to meet the pre-96 revalued pensions, which had been provided by the ODA, proved to be too little. And the first demand from the UK was that Gibraltar should pick up the tab and start paying after July 1988, when the funds available were exhausted. The UK wanted us to pay all of it. They said they were not putting a penny. And I remember in one of the conversations that we had that they said that they would simply stop payment and there would be riots in La Linea. And I said, well, I suppose La Linea and Gibraltar is 5,000 or 2,000 or whatever many miles away from you, and it's the same. We're equally distant from you. But I can tell you that if I pay, the riots will be in Gibraltar. And if I have to choose, I choose the La Linea riots, which are a million miles away as far as I'm concerned. So then they said they would be prepared to pay. But they wanted us to settle, to make a contribution, because they said that we should pay £1 million, which the AACR had offered to contribute, even though they considered it was not enough, and they were very generous to allow me to do a deal with just £1 million. And I was told that since that had been a commitment from the previous government, which had put £1 million on the table, I had to honor it. My reply was that from the opposition I had been saying not one penny, that I had a manifesto commitment that said not one penny, and that when the people voted for us, they had removed £1 million from the table, and now there was not even one penny left on the table. So the ODA diverted funds which had been voted by the UK Parliament to assist Gibraltar's infrastructure projects a long time before, and which the AACR had failed to spend and was still sitting in the ODA account. And they used that to avoid ending the payments in August 1988. This was done, by the way, without the agreement of the GSLP government, but we couldn't stop it. It was their money, and they had it in their account. The UK government agreed to continue the payments beyond 1988, but attached two conditions. Pension levels should be frozen at January 1989. They had some argument with some logic when they put the argument. Some logic, not all logic, because they were responsible for the whole business by giving the wrong advice to the AACR in the first place. But they were saying, well, look, if I am paying the pensions and you are deciding the increases, what is to stop you deciding tomorrow to double the increases and I have to pay? So I will pay the pensions as they are when we agree, which means if there are increases, you have to pay the increases to the Spanish pre-69 workers, because you cannot just increase it for the Gibraltarians. Okay? And there was some logic in their analysis that we would have the freedom to impose on them what they had to pay. But in any case, we had no choice. Either they stopped paying altogether, or they were willing to take on the responsibility for a period of 5 years with the condition that the first condition was that it was frozen, and the second condition was that the social security system had to be dissolved. We had to scrap the 1955 Act and have no social security system, and that the balance of the accumulated fund would be distributed with the UK paying pro rata lump sum payments to Spanish pensioners when this happened in December 1993. An insane proposition. That's a government, you know, when you're negotiating, sometimes you have no choice but to upset. What was the alternative? The alternative would have been perpetual war with our neighbors, who would have blamed Gibraltar for them not getting a pension that the British government was prepared to keep on paying them. The UK actually informed the Spanish government of this proposal and the EU Commission, and nobody reacted. And it seemed that only we were horrified at what they wanted to do. They thought it was quite normal. Spanish government thought it was normal. The EU Commission thought it was normal. Okay. So, in 1989, the government established a social assistance fund, which was entirely funded from the proceeds of import duty. The fund's objective included making grants to charitable organizations. And in 1989, a charitable organization, the Gibraltar Community Care Limited, was set up by a number of individuals, not by the government. It introduced a household cost allowance for assisting persons living in Gibraltar whose cost of living was and is and will continue to be much higher than those who live across the border. The household cost allowance was paid in December 89 at the rate of £26 per quarter for a single pensioner and £39 per quarter for a pensioner couple, irrespective of the existing level of pensions from the frozen social security plan. So therefore, whether you got the full pension or the minimum pension, you got the same payment. There was no link to the contributions or to the size of the pension. The structure that was to replace Gibraltar's social security system post-1993 was the subject of discussions with the United Kingdom, which were never ending. At first, the UK expert insisted that there could not be a state-run social insurance successor in Gibraltar, based on social security legislation, as it would be caught by EU regulations and be seen as a device to discriminate against the former Spanish pensioners by ending their pension entitlement but reinstalling a pension entitlement for Gibraltarian pensioners. They insisted that each pensioner and each worker contributing to the scheme up to December 1993 would receive a lump sum from the dissolution of the Gibraltar Social Security System, and that this lump sum would be transferred to an occupational private sector pension scheme, which would be a money purchase scheme. After innumerable meetings and considerable work to try and meet the UK's demands, the advice was reversed. The UK experts then decided that a private sector occupational pension scheme would not do, as it would breach the UK's requirements with aggregation and apportionment of social insurance pension rights based on contributions made in different member states, and that the government of Gibraltar was told it had to replace the existing scheme with a state-run public sector successor scheme, which was what we wanted to do in the first place, but we said we were not permitted to do. It shows, Mrs. Speaker, that this reliability on the expert advice that they produce, which had been the source of the problem in the first place, was not advice as you are dealing with people who never made mistakes. They made colossal mistakes throughout. The public sector scheme would then operate only on the basis of contributions made from 1994 without any credits for persons who had not retired but had been contributed under the scheme up to 1993. Let me see if I can explain that, right? The Spanish pensioners are the people who were withdrawn in order to cripple our economy and bring us to our knees in 1969. And they pay £38. Right? In Gibraltar, we have the two-job society. We tighten our belt. We do everything we need to do. The UK gives us some money. And we keep on going with a closed frontier and keep on paying insurance. Now, because they decided that at the meeting in Brussels and in the Commission, that we have to pay the people who left and paid £38, not £1, but the £48 that has been earned by the contributions of other people subsequently, in a bill that is £250 million, that we have to pay the £250 million, which is a physical impossibility. Not even I can produce that kind of money. Or we have to, first of all, not have a social insurance scheme which everybody else has, which they had had since 1948, which we had had since 1955. No. We have to have a money purchase scheme. And then they don't say this is the wrong thing to do, this is immoral what we're doing to these people. No, they say, no, the EU won't let us do it. Okay, no, you have to have a social insurance scheme. But all the insurance that you paid between 1969 and when we put the new one in 1985, all that money, all those contributions will not count in the successor ones of 1994. So in January 1994, they will stop paying in 1993. Everybody will then get their money back, right, which was going to be distributed, or Now the money back, which has to be put in a separate fund and will not be used to end. So people who were, say, 64 in 1993 would have had 1 year to pay for the new pension, because the what had been paid in 1993 could not be counted. That was the second brainwave. On the suspension of the pension payments, the Spanish pensioners were informed that in accordance with the 89 UK-Gibraltar agreement accepted by the Spanish government at the time, they would receive lump sum payments. Let me tell members an interesting anecdote about what happened when that took place. I mentioned in relation to the accusations from the Honourable Mr. Bocino that I am against cooperation and that I was against Brussels because I'm against cooperation, that we had set up a council which included Ceuta, and that in Ceuta was where we had the last meeting. When we were in Ceuta and we had the last meeting, I warned Pepe Caracau and the other leaders of the municipalities, look, the UK government is now going to remind the Spanish government of what they told them 5 years ago, which is, this was in December, this is the last month that you get paid pensions. And since most of the people who were frontier workers are in your municipalities, you're going to get a reaction, so I'm just giving you friendly warning, you know, in this cordial cooperation council that we had, that this is going to happen. And since we were having this meeting in Ceuta, I said at the end of the meeting, look, this is off a record, not on it, but I can tell you this is happening now in Madrid, so you better think of how you're going to deal with this. But this is something that the Spanish government has known for 5 years and the EU has known for 5 years. Okay. So I came back here. We had the meeting of the House. And when I came back here, the then leader of the opposition asked me how the meeting had gone in Ceuta. And I said, it went very well, you know, we're very optimistic that we can do lots of things together. He says, well, how is it that Señor Caracau has just been interviewed as president of the Mancomunidad and said that the work of the Our Lady of Europa Cooperation Council is now finished, that they are all withdrawing their participation in it because you kicked him in the shins under the table in Ceuta? I said, I haven't kicked anybody in Ceuta at all. No? So, you see, this is what some politicians are like. I gave the guy friendly warning and then he came out with this, and it's all in the record of Hansard if anybody is interested in looking it up. And that is what stopped the cooperation. The cooperation stopped because the politicians in the municipalities had to do some gesture to defend themselves and show anger at the action of the United Kingdom, which is totally irresponsible, of course. But in January, people were left without pensions, there and here. And the Junta de Andalucía then instructed all their pensioners in the Campo area not to accept the lump sum and advanced loans to them equivalent to the level of pension they were getting for the 5 years between 88 and when the pensions was closed. So I did the same. We did the same in the government. We gave what the Andalusian government was giving to the Spanish nationals, we gave to the Gibraltarian pensioners. And therefore, the UK had triggered what the plan was, but the trigger failed because the Junta of Andalusia took compensatory action to protect their pensioners, and obviously we did exactly the same, and they could not stop me doing it Because how could they defend that? I couldn't do for my pensioners what the junta could do for theirs. But it meant that the money that was supposed to be given back to the pensioners as a lump sum to get rid of the problem was never distributed because it wasn't accepted. So the situation then was that on instructions from the Junta de Andalucía, the bulk of the pensioners refused the payment, and then they gave them loans, and the UK then was faced with a problem at the EU level. The UK argued that they had no obligation under EU law to keep on paying social insurance pensions for life, or at any given level, anyway, that the Spanish pensioners argued that there was a legitimate expectation. Well, I don't think there was a legitimate expectation in the first place, but certainly by giving it to them in the Brussels meeting at the beginning, the expectation was created that once you start paying those pensions, they are for life. The Spanish pensioners commenced then legal action against the government of Gibraltar, funded by the Andalusian government, using the chambers of Mr. Triay and Triay, which at the time had Peter Caruana as partner. The Gibraltar government was alleged to be discriminating against the Spanish workers on the grounds that community care was continuing to pay social security pensions, which it was not, which had been suspended in the case of the Spanish workers. So Andalusian government thought that they were giving loans, or we were giving loans, and they thought it's not that we were giving loans, but that the community care was giving pensions, and that's why people here were happy with the system. There was absolutely no substance in this allegation, since the pensions had been suspended for both Gibraltarians and Spanish pensioners, and Community Care Limited had been given household consalados since 1989. So it's not that they started doing it when the fund was closed. They had been doing it all the time. So it was not from 1994 at the time of the suspensions of the pensions, as they thought. In 1994, the EU Commission took up the question of the dissolution of the Social Insurance Fund with the UK government, and as a result of receiving complaints from Spanish pensioners, who at the time were in receipt of a temporary loans from the Junta. The UK refused to provide the Gibraltar government, us, with details of its exchanges with the Commission, and copies of the correspondence claiming that these matters were confidential. They expected us to pay, but it was confidential and we couldn't know what was going on. By October 1995, the Commission issued a reasoned opinion against UK on the grounds that the decision to dissolve the Social Insurance Fund was in breach of EU law. The initial position of the UK on the replacement of the occupational private sector pension system was also considered by the commissioners to be against EU law. UK's position at first was that they would defend the decision before the European Court of Justice on the basis that there was no obligation to have a state-run statutory social insurance system or to have any given level of pension rates, that this was up to each member state to do as it pleased, and it was not mandatory under European law. However, early in 1996, the EU capitulated when faced with imminent infraction proceedings and decided to restore the frozen pension system. This history shows, Mr. Speaker, a relationship of struggle with the British government where consistently the government of Gibraltar is proved right, and the UK government is proved wrong, capitulates and changes its position. And we were supposed to be the aggressive side in that relationship in the campaign that the GSD had against us. They decided to restore the position which had been terminated in 1993 and which had operated in 1989. In the course of the meetings, I was asked to agree to restore the frozen social security pensions backdated to 1994, which I had no promises, I didn't want to freeze them, to close the system in the first place, and the for the 80, this was done then to contain the 88 to 93 cost to £50 million, as opposed to £250 million that the whole thing would have cost if these steps had not been taken. So now we were being told, okay, we are going back, no lump sum, we are going back to the pensions, but now we don't just want them frozen for 5 years, we now want them frozen until the last pre-1969 pensioner dies. Well, that would have been a very long time, because there are lots of stories about guys having their thumb preserved after death to come and have a fingerprint here and still collect the pension, so where they could have been much more than 250 million. Naturally, I refuse to give any such undertaking. So the United Kingdom said, we will restore it on this condition. And I said, I don't accept the condition. The United Kingdom position was that they would not proceed then with paying for the restoration of the frozen pension payments until this matter was cleared up. So here we were. They said this can be done. They said we're going to fight it in the European courts. Then they said, okay, we can't. It cannot be done. The European courts is right. They tell us, freeze and close down. Then they say, unfreeze and come back, but keep the new one frozen forever. I had agreed to a text of the letter provided by them as to the commitments that they would require prior to this question of the household cost allowance being raised, but would not accept that the letter should be amended to include any reference to the payments by community care. My position was that since they were saying that there was no legal obligation to continue with frozen pensions, they should go ahead and let the Commission commence infraction proceedings and defend themselves in the European Court of Justice, using the arguments in the court that they had been using with me to persuade me in 1988 to agree to the dissolution of the system in 1993. Following the 1996 general election, the official opening of the House of Assembly, in my statements as leader of the opposition, I made these facts public. I made this public, and then later in 1996, the new government brought legislation to the House of Assembly to restore the frozen pensions, backdated to 1994, and claimed that there had not been any negotiations on this matter with the British government, and they were simply giving effect to what had been agreed with me, which was something that had not been agreed with me, because they refused to accept my condition to keep community care out, but apparently without any effort on the part of the GSD, they agreed with the GSD to leave community care out of the equation. Having given this level of detail, Mr. Speaker, let me now summarize how I see the essence of the detailed explanations that I've shared with the honorable members opposite, and what this indicates about how they've behaved in this context. In 1992, community care was providing support to pensioners and widows, and was asked by Minister Robert Moore to introduce a scheme for the employment of the over 60 unemployed men willing and able to work and not finding a job because of competition from younger applicants in the labour market. What he called a social wage, which meant that rather than people depending on social assistance, those in need could provide useful duties in the community and receive the equivalent of a part-time job on the national minimum wage, which had been introduced in 1989, doing 80 hours a month of community duties. This is what started in 1992, continued after 1996 until 2008. 16 years, most of the time under the GSD, most of the time. It was changed after 2008. In 2008, community care was asked by the GSD government to extend it to everyone, whether working or not, with an income from work but not from occupational pensions, which had to be either below 15,000 in order to come into the scheme, and not above 20, otherwise you were debarred. So you had to have less than £20,000 and £15,000 or more as a minimum. By 2009, as a result of the change, it grew so big that the charity could not provide enough community duties to those that they paid, and reduce the requirement from 80 hours a month to 8. At the same time, the GSD had been planning all the time to close down community care by letting it run out of money, as was revealed in an interview in the Chronicle in 2010, and set up a committee to stop funding the charity and pay statutory benefit system. To have means-tested HCA or some other product. The GSD government set up a committee of senior civil servants in 2009 and announced their plan as government policy in the New Year message of 2010, in a lengthy interview in the Chronicle and in the budget session in the House. They defended the policy on the grounds that it had to be done to protect government finances from claims for equal treatment from frontier workers, and might be legally successful and create a liability on the public funds described by the then Chief Minister as a ticking time bomb. The government was not willing to provide the opposition with any information of how this was going to be brought about. The implementation date was delayed, and during the election campaign of 2011, they confirmed it was ready to initiate in January 2012. In opposition, former GSD ministers claimed not to know anything about these plans, even though they were candidates in the election that contained the commitment. In 2015, they announced a change in policy and said they would continue the present system of community funding from community care. We were elected in 2011 and started refunding the community care, which had no reserves when we came in. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, when we came back and provided the funding, community care continued simply with the policy that the GSD had asked them to introduce in 2009. They found themselves with the money. We didn't go and say to them what they could use the money for or not use the money for. The result was that in the last 8 years, the charity has dished out almost £40 million from funding we provided in a scheme that was originally designed by us to help those in need. The recipients consisted of practically the entire male resident population between the ages of 60 and 65, including a former chief minister, a former chief secretary, close to the chief minister, receiving £6,000 a year from the charity for supposedly doing some community services for 8 hours a month. It's to perpetuate that the members marched. From day one, the charity has been funded from the receipt of import duty, initially directly and later with the payment of approved through the social assistance fund, but identified as through the source. This has been done by both the GSLP and the GSD government as necessary to prevent anybody claiming an entitlement as taxpayers or contributor to the social security. We've known all the time why the word entitlement was lethal. We knew it, and they knew it. So the GSD wanted to close it down in 2011 because there was a risk of a challenge, changed their mind in 2015, agree there is no risk, and in 2021 take part in a demonstration on the basis that the payments from the charity is an entitlement which forms part of a statutory pension system, creating the very risk that the Chief Minister said he was trying to avoid in 2010 when they believed it was there. Mr. Speaker, you could not make this up. Let me spell it out for the opposition. What they are supporting is for community officers, and what the Honourable Member, the Lady Honourable Member, wishes to extend to everyone that has paid 50 contributions to our social security system in their lifetime, making it legally binding to make payments from the age of 60 for which there is no funding, and no funding is ever likely to exist, which will probably finish costing more than the Spanish pre-1969 pension claim. The decision of the members opposite to publicly support the arguments of entitlement of persons who have retired from work, some voluntarily at the age of 50, who already at the age of 50 knew they would be facing hardship at the age of 60 in the future, if the system was not continued. I wish I knew who these guys are. They're better than me at predicting what's going to happen. I've only got a 4-year span. And that making it like, and then the decision of the members opposite is to publicly support these arguments of entitlement of persons who have retired with incomes of several multiples of the national minimum wage, convertible or converted into six-figure lump sums. It is the most irresponsible, incomprehensible and dangerous behavior I have witnessed from elected members in my 49 years of membership of this parliament. It is a level of insanity without parallel, inexplicable and indefensible, to put our country's future at risk in order, presumably, to obtain some electoral advantage, because there's no other logic to this. If they were in government with a policy of delivering what they are now promising, which of course is not necessarily what they would do, because for 15 years they promised to protect community care, and they were making false promises, and instead of ensuring its survival, they were planning its disappearance secretly for 15 years. But at least Sapita Caruana, who was guilty of that deceit, eventually came clean and went public and explained why he was doing it. Let me remind the present members of the GSD how the GSD government planned to close down community care. In the last quarter of 2009, the GSD government set up a working party which was formed to brainstorm ideas for the possible reform of the social insurance and social assistance systems. The working party consisted of the following participants: Dilip Dayaram Tirardas, Financial Secretary; Mario Romilia, Principal Secretary DSS; Frank Carreras, Commissioner of Income Tax; Mary Carmen David, DSS, SEO; Stephanie Saez, DSS, HEO. The agenda included the following items: Gibraltar Community Care current benefits, Gibraltar Community Care cash flow statement, current social insurance benefits and social assistance payment, statutory payments, statutory benefit fund, current position and year-end projection, social assistance fund, current position, background information on criteria for inclusion of benefits as special non-contributory benefits, Council Regulation 1408/71, introduction of special non-contributory benefits. The the party that had been empaneled by the GSD government considered the following options. The existing community care benefits could either be discontinued in February 2010, discontinued when the Gibraltar community care runs out. So I was scaremongering, was I? Alternately, the payment of these benefits could be closed to new applicants only. New applicants only, isn't that what the people with the placards are complaining about? And continue to be paid to existing beneficiaries, isn't that what community care has done? On a closed scheme, personal to holder basis. Some transitional arrangements in the winding down of the schemes would also be need to be considered. New benefits would then be introduced to enhance the basic state pension, the old age pension, in the form of SNCBs. The SNCB seems to be a shortening of a non-statutory, special non-contributory benefits. Okay? A system of tax credits could be introduced for the over 60s. The existing pensioners' utility grants could be extended to cover the cost of electricity, water and telephone charges. Other areas of possible reform were looked at into as follows. The streamlining and simplification of the benefit systems and the social insurance and social assistance schemes. The possibility of transferring some functions in unemployment benefits in order to minimize duplication of work. They took into account that the qualifying period would continue to be 45 years for men and 40 years for women. In relation to the issue of the benefits currently payable by community care, the following was discussed. The possibility of integrating this benefit with the social insurance social assistance scheme, replacing some of all these benefits with other payments or benefits that might be classed or could be classed as non-exportable under EU regulations. The integration of Gibraltar community care benefits within the social insurance scheme would decrease the liabilities of the social insurance scheme significantly. This is because the state pensions are exportable and insured persons who work in Gibraltar for just 1 year are entitled to a pro rata pension. Alternative benefits that would not be exportable or that could be classed as special non-contributive benefits, SNCB, were therefore considered to be more appropriate. The requirements under the relevant EU regulations were looked at in order to establish that these benefits were non-exportable. In order for the benefit to qualify, it would need to be a cash benefit, non-contributory, funded out of general compulsory taxation, not based on aggregations of periods of employment or contribution, and based on individual assessment of financial need. Does anybody really think that that individual assessment of financial need would not apply to all the people that are now complaining? This was being planned in 2009. The party submitted the report on the 18th of December 2009. That was the secret plan initially to be delivered before 2011 general election and then deferred to be implemented after the Chief Minister Caruana said there was a ticking time bomb and as long as community care existed because it was charitable payments could be challenged. The challenge might be successful and the UK this time round would not pay. Gibraltar would face a massive bill. But what the present leader of the opposition and the rest of the GSD have done by supporting the campaign and the arguments and the demonstration against community care is 1,000 times worse than what the Chief Minister Caruana did. They've just legitimized what we have spent 32 years trying to protect community from. The members opposite told us in 2015 they knew nothing of this. which they were committed to implement if they were elected in 2011. That's why I have difficulty in believing it. Because if they do nothing, why didn't they ask? It was being said publicly. How can you be a minister and you hear publicly this community care is not going to be there after the election and you don't ask the person who is saying it, well, how is that going to happen? I was asking. None of the ministers were asking. This policy was reflected in the Chief Minister's New Year message, which included the following passage, which shows the connection. When in 2007, the UK paid the Spanish claim for pre-1969 workers, that is to say, the final settlement of the 250 million bill, which was part of the Cordoba Agreement, based on their challenge to community care, which Gibraltar has always told the UK was its responsibility, the UK made clear to that Gibraltar would have to meet the financial cost of any successful EU challenge by post-1969 current Spanish workers in Gibraltar, who eventually might make the same claim. Whatever we may think of the merits, was Peter Caruana's New Year message, whatever we may think of the merits of such a claim, it represents a financial time bomb ticking under our children and grandchildren in the future, for which they have to recourse, they will have no recourse to UK. I am not willing, he said, to bequeath this potential lethal legacy of a massive and unaffordable backdated claim to our future generations. And so this year, the government will, as I said at budget time, introduce significant reforms to protect Gibraltar from this possibility. The reform will not result in financial loss to our pensioners or recipients of community care. Well, Mr. Speaker, I am not willing to bequeath this lethal legacy of massive and unaffordable backdated claims to our future generations either. I do not believe what was there carried that risk. I believe that what is being done now does carry that risk. Because before, there wasn't one Gibraltarian saying it. It was all being said by people on the other side. But now, there are Gibraltarians saying it, there are elected members saying it, there's the official opposition saying it, and there's a letter to the governor saying it, to be transmitted, no doubt, for the governor to transmit it back to UK. How can a chief minister deliver a new mayor, a new year message like that, and his ministers not have a clue what it's all about? On something which a chief minister says is so serious that it is an unforgivable act of irresponsibility. That's what he told me. It was unforgivable and irresponsible of me to not give my support. And all I was saying is, I will support you if you show me how you're going to do it. I wasn't saying, I will not support you. I was saying, I will support you, but you have to convince me. I wasn't on that. It was totally irresponsible. In 2015, Mr. Fitton, as leader of the opposition, brushed aside all my arguments and said it was just a change of policy. A change of policy from believing it's a ticking time bomb to believing it's a dumb squib. Not dangerous at all. Some change in policy. Would Mr. Bosino would no doubt compare with St. Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus. He then ridiculed my concerns and my request for clarification of what was being planned by saying I was caught up in a time warp. I was living in the past. Yeah. Well, Mr. Speaker, if I was in a time warp in 2015, it was a future time warp. Because here we are. The problem is here and now, not in the past. So my concerns on 2015 have now materialized in 2021. Well, let me tell the honorable members of the GSD that Mr. Peter Caruana, Mr. Fitam's hero, the greatest leader in Juru Teria, was correct. If he was correct in identifying the danger, then they, and in particular those who were part of the government at the time, have now increased the risk identified in 2009 exponentially. As for the honorable lady, words fail me to describe the insanity of the policy she has adopted and the language she has used in the article published in the Chronicle to defend it. I will remind the House so that we have a record of this insanity if the time ever comes when we need to apportion blame. If ever the Spanish campaign needed an ally to improve their chances of success, they have just found one in her. I will tell her what the Spanish campaign I think they are entitled to. They are entitled to not just pensions, schooling and everything else, because they say it's being paid by their taxes, and they've put out press releases saying it. She has said the payment should be made irrespective of residence, which goes even beyond the Campo area and their claims, as there are persons getting social insurance pensions but never having claimed household cost allowance, and they're resident throughout the European Union by virtue of having paid 1 year of contributions in their lifetime here. We are talking potentially of hundreds or even thousands of new recruits to the entitlement culture. The mistake by her father led to the first problem with the pension payment. Peter Caruana tried to remove the risk that the mechanism that was put in place he felt was creating to put right what her father had done wrong, and I didn't agree that such a risk existed, Mr. Speaker. But she has now made a statement capable of creating the risk that Peter Caruana envisaged, supporting the right to claim household cost allowance and included in it even those who have never ever thought of claiming it before. If the GSD was right in 2009, what she proposes is not just a ticking time bomb, it's an atomic ticking time bomb. This government is not going to be the one that makes the ticking time bomb explode. Indeed, as Minister for Restoring Financial Stability, if such a step were contemplated, I would have to advise the government that financial stability could not be achieved. The impact of such a policy on government finances would be much worse than the impact of the pandemic lockdown effect, which we have experienced and which continues to be causing us to have deficits. If this issue is not resolved by those complaining or those giving support and encouragement from the opposition benches to the campaign, and by them not coming to their senses and abandoning the dangerous road they've embarked on, then the best thing might be to call an early election just on this issue and let those who want to implement the huge payouts explain to the electorate how they're going to save Gibraltar from the disastrous consequences of what they're advocating on public finances and the elimination of community care, which we have been defending since 1989, the day it was set up 32 years ago, Mr. Speaker. A struggle of 32 years shared with the GSD, one of the few things that we both fought the same side on, to protect community care, now being put at risk for what? It seems as if they wanted to make sure that they inflicted the maximum possible damage on Gibraltar's finances and viability. The honorable members opposite have supported a petition which gets handed to the governor, who presumably is expected to make sure it reaches the UK government, which does the very thing that Sir Peter Caruana claimed he feared could happen, that they say they don't pay, and then sets him on a course of dismantling the role of community care, because strictly speaking, he could not dismantle the charity, but only started funding, which he had already been doing for 15 years. The document they are supporting claims a version of history argued in the past in the UK and fought against by the GSLG government up to 1996 and the GSD government after 96 until 2007. The document implies UK was right and our defense of the charity was wrong. A defense which the leader of the opposition for a time was a minister in the GSD government defending Gibraltar and putting the contrary view. He was part of the GSC that was defending what I am saying, the same way we had defended it. The opposition have publicly and officially supported the incorrect argument that the household cost allowance provided by community care was created by a GSC government in 1988 in lieu of paying pension increases to all pensioners. In 2002, the GSD told the UK, in 1989 there was established in Gibraltar by a group of private individuals, not what the people organizing the petition say, by a group of private individuals, a private charitable trust, Community Care Trust, with the object of performing a range of charitable functions for elderly persons in Gibraltar. Amongst its object, the trust pays a financial sum to persons of pensionable age in Gibraltar to assist them in meeting household costs, electricity, water, and other utility and household costs, which are particularly high in Gibraltar given the diseconomies of scale which apply here. Household cost allowance is paid at the same rate to persons on the minimum and the maximum pensions. The minimum is 25% of the maximum. So it's therefore not in lieu of pension increases as the petition says and as the governor has been told and as the British government is going to be told and as the Spaniards were claiming and as we were denying. It is not in lieu of anything. Furthermore, if it were a replacement for pension increases, it would not be happening because it was supposed to be a replacement for when they were frozen and they were unfrozen a very long time ago and it's still being paid. They were frozen at the instigation of the UK and unfrozen as a result of the United Kingdom paying £60 million to pre-1969 pensioners in the Cordoba Agreement. So, if that was what they were, they would have stopped when the Cordoba Agreement was done. And they were not stopped. And it was the GSD that was there. The household cost allowance was not stopped when the pension increases were reinstated after Cordoba. The petition, the Honourable Member Support, says the household cost allowance is a scheme for Gibraltar resident men 60 years plus and for men aged 65 plus that was created by the GSLP government in 1988 in lieu of state pension increases to all pensioners. Not to. Is this a new policy of the opposition to say that this is true? How can you say we support a petition, march up Main Street, if you know it's not true? Because it wasn't what you were saying before. It's the first time you said it. If so, when did they decide to abandon the previous position shared with the GSLP, which they have defended since 1996? Are they now reneging on the statement of Mr. Fitam as leader of the opposition in the 2015 motion, which I brought to the House, when he said a GSD government would continue funding the independent charity as we were doing and retain its role? The charity's role is not and has never been to provide a combination of household cost allowance and the state pension so that the two form the equivalent of this country state pension, as the petition says. If that is now their position, they had better start looking for a few hundred million pounds because the residence requirement would be the breach of EU law in how it has been paid in the past and would need to be stopped once this interpretation is accepted. They had better go back and review the results of the committee they set up in 2009 but pretended it never existed or that no one in the government knew it existed. And furthermore, they had better tell the people who signed the petition and those who wrote the text to get community officer allowance as a statutory payment that the GSD-sponsored study group found in 2009 that all such payments could only be provided by the state if they were based on need. And this means tested, and certainly not at 21,000, but inevitably at the rate of the national minimum wage or even lower. Means tested. The household cost allowance would radically limit its implication, which currently is that every resident pensioner gets it on top of his pension, increases, the pension is increased and the household cost allowance is on top, irrespective of any other income. And finally, members opposite had better put their thinking hat on and come up with how they get themselves out of their new policy commitment, because they've just opened a Pandora's box and we may not be able to close it. I think I would like to tell them now about the National Economic Plan. the positive side. Mr. Speaker, the strategy I put together in 2019, which is reflected in the 1920 National Economic Plan, is designed to change how we deliver growth. It is about laying the foundations for Gibraltar's future as a trading nation. In the election, I often reminded people how in 1988 we had to change the way we made a living after years of almost total dependence on the UK defence budget, which in Gibraltar had been declining since 1984, in my view, as part of the process of talks with Spain initiated with the Strasbourg talks after Franco's death in 1976. He died in 1975, the talks started in 1976. The transformation in 1988 was possible because people understood and accepted the need for change. It created an economic model with two elements. A global one in gaming and financial services based in Europol, serving an international and United Kingdom customer base, and a local element serving visitor numbers arriving by sea, air and land. The day visitor traffic by land making the biggest contribution to revenues and employment. The tourist surveys clearly show this. In 2019, tourist expenditure reached an all-time high of 308 million. And a year later, in 2020, an all-time low, last seen in 1998. The principal source of the expenditure that the day visitors from across the border in 2019 provided £255 million, the highest level since 2011, and fell to the lowest level since 1993 at £61 million. This is in the context of what we might expect of a Schengen border, or if there is not an acceptable treaty that provides fluidity for day trips in and out of Gibraltar. What we're seeing now could become the permanent feature. We need to know that and face it. The figures for the land visitors are unlikely to show much recovery this year. In the light of the continuing COVID measures, even if there is more fluidity, it is unlikely to go back to previous numbers, since a high proportion of the visitors who came in coaches were UK citizens on holiday in Spain. The fall in numbers of customers was quite dramatic last year in respect of all three methods of arrival. The low value, high volume model required imports of labour and goods, with the supply principally coming from the same direction as the bulk of the customers, overland. The new economy, for which we are setting the foundations now, And this is happening 18 months later than I intended, although as much preparatory work as possible has been done in the period since the general election, which I hope will be reflected in showing tangible results this financial year. But what we have to move into now is the emergence of Gibraltar as a trading nation. We must see Brexit not as a disaster, but as an opportunity to do in the future what we could not do in the past. The following data on some of our international trade indicates what has been happening and how well we are doing in competing with other markets. The potential volume of business we can deliver, limited to activities within Gibraltar, would be very small and incapable of restoring high levels of economic growth if we just bring people to sell in Gibraltar. This will continue to happen in a small way, of course, but what is much more important and has more potential is attracting new businesses that will have their head office in Gibraltar and subsidiary companies in other jurisdictions. Currently, the Ministry for Economic Development is engaged in discussion with a number of such potential new partners on a global scale that fit the characteristics of the new model, and if these discussions are successful that are taking place and if they finish successfully, the outcomes of the details will then be published. Trade with UK is one important part of the strategic development of the new economy, and it is worth noting what has been happening in our bilateral trade following Brexit and the pandemic breakdown. The Honourable Mr. Clinton has said the subject of Brexit, and indeed a hard Brexit, is one that deserves close economic analysis because, of course, its meaning is different in a UK context to a Gibraltar context. I agree. And it is relevant to see that, in fact, how trade has affected UK and Gibraltar. UK's international trade is down with almost all its partners, but it's probably much more likely a result of the lockdown than the Brexit, which in theory has not been a hard one since there has been a post-withdrawal trade agreement. Since 2011, total trade with UK in billions of pounds per year with Gibraltar has been 2011, 1.6 billion, 2012, 2.6 billion, 2013, 2.3 billion, 2014, 2.9 billion, 2015, 2.6 billion, 2016, 2.6 billion, and the Brexit referendum. 2017, 3.4 billion, 2018, 4.1 billion, 2019, 4.6 billion, 2020, 3.8, and the pandemic lockdown. So we see a clear movement when the Brexit referendum happens of an increase in our bilateral trade and a slowdown in what has been increasing when the pandemic comes in. Gibraltar was at 3.8 million in the four quarters to the end of quarter 2020, that is by December 2020. This was a decrease of 16.1% or £740 million from the end of quarter 2019, that is coming down from the 4.6 to the 3.8. Of the 3.8 billion, because the billion is the combined amount in both directions, okay? UK exports to Gibraltar amounted to 3.3 billion in the four quarters to the end of 2020, a decrease of 19.2% or 774 million compared to quarter four of 2019. Gibraltar was UK's 44th largest trading partner in the four quarters to 2020 and accounted for 0.3% of the total UK trade. In those four quarters, the UK imported from Gibraltar value of £581 million, which was an increase of 6% or £34 million compared to the four quarters of 2019. But we still run a trade deficit with them, as I recently pointed out to the people who came out from the Foreign Office, that we are helping the balance of payments by having a deficit. And we're also helping sterling. The UK trade with Morocco and Malta, which I've looked up in order to give some sort of comparator that, so that we can judge our performance, which looks very attractive and healthy. Trade with Morocco and Malta fell back in 2020. By comparison, the goods and services between the UK and Morocco was 1.4 billion in the four quarters of 2020. It had been 1.3 billion in 11. So Morocco finished up not with a drop which took the trade back from 2020 to 2019, and it's the pandemic. In the case of Morocco, it went back from what it was in 2019 to what it was in 2011. 1.3 and 1.4. In 18 and 19, they had 2.1. Better, but you know, 50% higher. But we're talking about 1.4 billion. The total goods and services between Malta and the UK had been 1.4 billion in 11. It went up to in 18 to 2 billion to 2.8 in 2019, and then it fell to 1.2 in 2020. The total goods and services between the next highest one after us is Slovakia, which is ahead of us with 4.4 billion. Well, look, we were at 4.6. We were ahead of Slovakia in 2019, and we are now just behind them. Our trade after the drop is higher by £1 billion than the combined trade with Malta, which I chose because it's a Mediterranean location. It's had the kind of relationship where with UK, you would expect them to be buying UK products like we do, and with Morocco, because this is where I see an opportunity for us to be enlarging our presence and being able to increase trade with Morocco and help in increasing trade between Morocco and the UK. This figure shows that what I would like to see us being able to do is not spy in the sky. The evidence that we've got is that there is a potential there where perhaps we've tended to neglect because we've had money coming in fairly easily, frankly, without having to do a great deal. That is the truth of it. It's the reason for the entitlement culture, and it's the reason for us not being more proactive in searching new markets and searching new things. Well, now we have to. It's not a question of choice anymore. And therefore, in putting this before the House is, in fact, to make them understand that there are things that are being looked at which have got serious potential for us being able to overcome the hole that we're in. I'm talking still about the economy. I'm not talking about the government finances. But and therefore, you know, the government finances may take a couple of years to finally start getting the benefit of these new areas of activity. These things are not things that can be done in one day, and the establishment of this will, in all probability, not hit government revenues this side of the election, because look, we've already used up 1.5 years of the four, and we're going to be starting now. If there's no more resurgence of pandemic and people don't start closing down again. So in 2018, our trade went up 2 billion to reach 4.6 billion compared to 1.6 billion in 2011. We are looking to increase this trade in 2021 and in future years. I am quite hopeful that I shall be able fairly soon to lead a trade mission abroad with a number of projects which will entail inward investment in those countries from new investors setting up corporate headquarters for the investments from Gibraltar. I am particularly excited by one which involves an Israeli investor who is an inventor and who has designed a car for the taxi trade which meets the criteria of the secular economy, which I will explain later. And I consider to be so important for us to support, where the vehicle is not sold but paid for by usage. A state-of-the-art design of a vehicle that would be produced in microfactories in different jurisdictions. The microfactory would be produced in Germany, linked to a university. I've already talked to the professor that is in charge of this. He came in on a private jet for one day to discuss it. It specializes in research in modern technology and the conversion of these results in delivering it to the market. This approach in manufacturing is an alternative to the mega factory producing millions of cars and requiring vast movement of energy in the transportation of components from one country to another. The microfactory requires less energy consumption. It is designed to meet local demands, so the product isn't transported across from one end of Europe to the other. And it's not just for Europe. It would employ a couple of hundred workers in two shifts and on a footprint of 60,000 square meters deliver something like 30,000 cars annually. And the investment of this is in tens of millions of dollars instead of hundreds of thousands. It is much more environmentally friendly concept and it's designed to minimize waste. If we are successful in sponsoring the development, the microfactories would be subsidiaries of the Gibraltar parent that is expected to have a quoted value, according to the people who want to set it up, in excess of $1 billion US dollars. It would be the highest value UK company. I am sharing this information with honorable members to reassure them that I am thinking outside the box on how to reposition our economy. I am not doing it to encourage them to start finding fault to try and stop me. I would like to close, Mr. Speaker, with my concerns for the environment as I did in 2019. Beyond the green economy, that is the secular economy, which in my judgment is the only initiative that has a chance of stopping the climate change catastrophe. The green economy is not enough because it only addresses how we produce what we consume. It says nothing about the fact that we consume too much. What it does is say we should produce what we consume with a less polluting, more environmentally friendly technology. So if consumption of electricity is very high and growing, what is wrong is that it is produced by fossil fuels. So we have natural gas instead of oil, which is less polluting, or wind and wave power or solar power, which is greener, but we can still continue consuming ever higher amounts of electricity per capita. Of course, even if the green energy source is less damaging and less CO2 producing, it still needs to use raw materials and metals to manufacture the substitute technology. The scientific evidence is that 91% of the resources we take from nature is wasted to enable us to consume the remaining 9%. The really disruptive approach is to develop a new way of life, a new approach to consumption, which many see as a novelty, but in my view is going back to how we used to do things and apply the same principles, the same approach, the same philosophy, except that we do so with what is possible today and in the future with the latest technology. Let me explain what I mean, Mr. Speaker. I call it the belling system. Mr. Speaker, I can remember when in my household my mother used to cook my food using charcoal. May not seem possible, but it's true. At one stage, we had the city council, which used to run municipal services before the 1969 constitution merged the city council and the colonial government, a city council, a colonia, in Llanito. The municipality came up with a way of introducing a mass shift to electric cookers. They bought cookers and leased them, as well as selling the electricity to the customer. The rental of the cooker made it available to low-income families who would not have been able to buy one, my family being one of them. The cookers were manufactured to last. They were provided, repaired, and replaced by the city council, and the scheme was self-financing for one reason and one reason only. The Belling cooker was built to last 50 years, not designed to have a limited life and be cheaper to replace than to repair. Indeed, I believe there are still some Bellings around our city and still working. This, which is my memory of the 1950s, is the hot technology of the future, which is considered by many serious scientists our only hope of slowing down and reversing climate change. Mr. Speaker, the decision taken by the European Parliament in 2020 and this year promoting an alternative lifestyle and production model for industry seems to me to be the only real hope we have that may reduce and then reverse the global warming and the climate change. Based on this analysis, our national economic plan will include a strategy of sponsorship for inward investment projects that promote the circular economy and support local initiatives that are compatible with that objective. However, I have to say that the prospect of success for that approach developing at a strong enough pace and on a sufficiently global scale are not very high in my judgment. We face the problem here on a miniature scale. Indeed, in this very room, between the 17 of us elected to protect Gibraltar and its future, can we protect Gibraltar from a catastrophic environmental disaster if the rest of the world does not act soon enough? The answer is clearly no. No one is safe anywhere on the planet. We have floods in the heart of the EU with no parallel in recent history, melting ice everywhere, and in particular in the two poles and Greenland, which can lead to rising sea levels and warming sea temperature. We are experiencing in the west coast of America and Canada temperatures in excess of 45 degrees and dry vegetation, which is causing spontaneous wildfires, which in turn will accelerate CO2 content of the atmosphere and produce more climate change. There's only one answer. Unless by some miracle we make a technological change which enables us to find virtually free, inexhaustible energy by harnessing the fusion process that provides the energy of the sun and in turn supports life on Earth, which I imagine will happen sooner or later, as there is a great deal of research and investment, but the issue is, will it happen soon enough? And if it were to happen, can it happen painlessly? Can we move from fossil fuels to inexhaustible clean energy without a huge disruption in the global economy and a huge shift in that economy in where the balance of wealth and political power will lie? Put out at the simplest level, can we make people understand in what is little more than a village of 30,000, which is what we are, that we cannot consume more than we can produce? or is that too difficult? That we cannot take more from the planet than we put back into it? Can we give leadership to people by telling them that it is not possible to have more of everything every year? But it requires a disruptive technology because it combines the philosophy of the past, building things to last and repair and reuse, with the technology of the future. This will not happen on a global scale, but if it is adopted, then it is the manufacturers and the designers that have to adopt it. And they will not do it if the consumers are unwilling to become users of the artifacts instead of owners. And this may really be the ultimate stumbling block, giving the place that ownership has in our social values as a way of reflecting the individual's importance in the eyes of the rest of the tribe, the person's peers, by whom most people feel they need to be judged in order to boost their self-esteem. In fact, it will only become possible if we are able to free citizens from the addictive condition that I described in the May 2019 budget, which I called compulsive consumption disorder, and described as the illness of Western civilization, and the illness which poorer societies aspire to also be contaminated with, so that they can stop having to reuse and repair and recycle, and instead use and dispose, which is the lifestyle which is predominant as sign of success. It is easy to understand how we got here. It makes short-term economic sense, because the concept of the polluter pays is just that, a concept. But in reality, the polluters were in the West and have not paid the price. Until very recently, the developing so-called poor countries, coincidentally the least polluting, have been the ones paying. But whether what is done is what is needed to be done is another matter. The National Economic Plan will evolve from a prospective future-proof plan to a post-pandemic future-proof plan by aligning itself with the future of where our civilization needs to be, the secular economy, promoting it, participating in it, and investing in it profitably. We are not going to change the world, but we have to be where the world needs to be if it is to survive the climate catastrophe that is threatening life on Earth. That paying more money to people who do not need it for doing nothing, and moreover, with money we do not have and need to borrow, is not to do so that they do not suffer hardship. And this is the opposite of what we should be doing, because what to do that is to enable them to increase the already high level of consumption. It is the very opposite of what the world needs us to be doing. It is not what we need to be doing in what is without a doubt the most difficult time in human history. Is it that the 17 of us cannot agree or are not willing to accept that this is the reality? That we have to spend less to consume, that we have to consume less, and that we have to pay ourselves less. If we don't, then the gap between us and the generations that follow us will go into reverse of what it has been until now. Each generation worse than the preceding one instead of better. Our destruction of the planet's ability to support life makes a human species the worst and most dangerous life form Earth has ever had. By comparison, the COVID virus is benign. And in addition, our continuing to increase our consumption levels will be the most selfish things that any human, and indeed any life form, have done in respect of protecting their offsprings. This is very simple, Mr. Speaker. The more we take out of this planet compared to what we put back, the less there will be for the generations that follow us. The rainy day fund concept of a socialist government in the 1980s, originally rubbish but now welcomed in theory, at least is a tangible proof of what needs to be done, is provide for those that follow us. This year is the first time in our history that we are talking about a deficit of 158 million and projecting a further deficit of 51 million. And we still have a debate about spending more and not raising revenue. If we think that this debate is all about who wins the next election, then let me tell the House that in the context of the issues that face Gibraltar as part of the global scenario in the field of economics and the environment, that the actions of the members of Homo sapiens, which they take and what they do in the lower part of the rock, is about as important as what the Barbary macaques do in their not dissimilar primate battles to gain influence in the upper part of the rock. The natural behavior of primates, in my humble opinion, of course, Mr. Speaker. Thank you.
Mr. Speaker, in order to enable us all to digest what we have just heard, which I think will be edifying for all of us, I would propose that the House should return at 4:15 to continue with other members' contributions.
The House will now recess to 4:15.